Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. We're back! It's August the 23rd of 2017. Last week, we just used the normal record time to do our Q&A session because there wasn't any manga to talk about, but there is this week. Quite a bit of it, in fact. Not only do we have a recommendation that we're going to be going through, but we've got all of the manga that we normally recap this week. We're going to get into that, but I guess first off, how you guys doing? How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing all right, Nick. I almost died the other day, though. Legit, I think, almost died. I guess I was very dehydrated when I went to sleep, and I didn't realize it. I woke up, and I was like, I'm going to go to the bathroom real quick. I was a little, groggy, but I was like, hey, you know, whatever. I'm always groggy when I wake up. This is nothing new. So I go to the bathroom, and as soon as I finish, I was like, oh, no, everything's spinning. Oh, no, and barely kept conscious enough to, stumble into the living room and, it was like animalistic strength just spawned into me as I tore into this bottle of water.
No!
I was like, get me! But I was like, man, had I not kept my consciousness there, I would have likely passed out straight into the toilet. And that's how it would have been found the next day, I guess. Cause I probably would have cracked my skull on it. It's not a large bathroom. There wasn't a lot of places for me to fall gently into. So, I guess this is a lesson, guys, that, life may always find a way to throw you into a toilet if you're not careful. And I guess drink more water. No.
I always go to bed with water next to me in case I wake up and I'm like, ugh, in the middle of the night. So.
Yeah, it was a weird moment. I didn't think I was that, cause I usually drink quite a lot of water, but I guess that was the one time I didn't have enough. I paid for that. That was a scary, 10 minutes of, waiting for my head to be like, all right, you're all right. Yeah, get back to bed, you dumb goober.
Being dehydrated sucks. I hate when, I'm sick and it dehydrates me that way. I do distinctly remember, one time being sick and being very dehydrated, and I took a shower, and immediately my body was like, oh, thank God, there's water here.
Oh, phew. Thanks.
Bye. Drool, sneeze, bleed, use it all.
I give it all unto you, Nicholas San. Your body refers to you like a Japanese classmate.
My very, very Japanese internal body water.
Yeah, it's like, Nick Sensei San, you need to drink more water. Like, what?
That's horrible Japanese, just putting random endings on things. I'm water. I don't really have a brain.
Yeah, I don't know.
Senpai.
I don't know the nuances of your language, dumbo.
Oh boy. All right. I am really not sure how we're going to break into talking about this manga. It's a weird one.
Yeah. This is going to be an interesting conversation. I'm legitimately not sure how this is going to go at all, because I think the only easy way I can sort of describe this series is very much a polarizing series, I imagine, because I knew nothing about this going into it. I had heard nothing about it. I didn't know this was a popular series at all, but I came to find out it very much was, because we've had people message us since we mentioned it was going to be our recommendation, saying I'm so excited, I'm really glad you guys are doing this, I can't wait for the episode to come out. And then I've had some people who have messaged us saying I hated that series, I couldn't get past the first four chapters or so, and it doesn't take long to understand why that is the case, but I'm very curious, because it is a series that our audience has had a very wide range of reactions to.
Definitely something that I think that if you have a low tolerance for shock value stuff, for the grosser side of humanity, then you're probably not going to be able to get into it, which I think is partially the point. Anyway, Akano Hana, which translates to Flowers of Evil, is, if I had to describe it purely in terms of manga that we've had to recap for the show prior, mostly Onani Master Kurosawa, A Silent Voice, and just a dash, just a hint of Homunculus, just a little bit thrown in there for good measure. Some weird imagery here and there, but mostly it's just about how growing from childhood to adulthood is an awkward experience. And you deal with some weird feelings, and it kind of sucks.
It's not quite as clear cut as that, though, because I think while we can all say, like, yeah, I had some awkward moments in my adolescence, I don't know if you had the sort of adolescence explored in this series.
Mm-hmm. We begin with this kid named Kasuga, who I think that they're, what, like 12 or something like that, basically?
Middle school, so yeah, right, I guess around 12.
12, 13, right in the height of adolescence, basically. And, oh, pardon me. He's got a crush on his classmate, Seiki? Sanako? Yep. Whatever. Seiki, I guess, is the easiest way to say it. Perfect girl, beautiful, idolized by the whole class, typical, perfect girl. And one day, while everyone else has gone home from class, except for one person, he ends up going back for this book that he has accidentally left in class, Le Fleur de Mal, which is a famous collection of poetry by a French author named Charles Baudelaire. We need to have like a French person on this.
No, your French has been wonderful. I'm sure Ben's eye wouldn't be screaming at all. He's like, you make his name sound like poop.
It's great. who basically, I have never read any Baudelaire. I'll say that flat out. And there are frequent references to him. The author is very clearly inspired by his work. But, the guy wrote a lot about very gross things in order to explore humanity. One of the poems from the Fleur de Mal is about how, oh, my date and I were walking along the road, and do you remember we saw a corpse there lying in the middle of the road? What a memory that was. Observations about weird, dark, gruesome things like that in order to really delve into psychology and humanity and stuff like that. So Kasuga reads this stuff, and in that very 12-year-old way, he thinks it makes him special that he reads this stuff and he enjoys it so much. He's not especially arrogant about it, but he definitely kind of gets a little fanboyish about it. Where he's like, if only Baudelaire were here, he could understand me, that kind of thing. When in fact, he's 12 and he doesn't really understand what the hell is about. He doesn't acknowledge it until much, much later that he has no idea what the fuck this stuff's about. And maybe if he did, he wouldn't have so many goddamn issues. Instead, he kind of, I think that the idea is that it influences him on more of a surface level. The interest in depravity and gross, disgusting things, which he ends up sharing with another classmate of his, a girl named Nakamura. Or if I keep calling her that, I'm just going to get wrestling image in my head, so I'm going to call her Sawa. But so Sawa ends up catching him when he is at the class after school this one day, picking up his book, because he comes across Seiki's gym clothes. And Kasuga is so enamored with Seiki, and he's such a horny little asshole that he, in the heat of the moment, just takes the chance and he steals her gym clothes and absconds with them. So this obviously, it causes a really big problem because, a young student's clothes were stolen from her. That's gross. So, the teacher is like, oh, if anyone knows anything about this or saw anyone in the classroom or whatever, bring that information forward. And, it turns Kasuga into this really guilt-ridden, paranoid kid until Sawa comes to him and is like, I saw you doing this and I'm going to tell everyone unless you do what I tell you to and form a contract with me. And, what essentially happens from there is that Sawa is also this very bizarre, antisocial kid who looks down on everyone, hates everyone, thinks that the world is full of scum, and I think she refers to everyone as worms and shit and stuff like that. and she sees something positive in the overt grossness of what Casca has done. So she wants to exploit that and see what she can discover from him. And that's how we start off. I think that covers about everything. It's been a couple of weeks since I've actually read this manga now.
Yeah, it mostly covers it. The only thing I'd clarify is that he doesn't just take the gym clothes out of, like, a heat-of-the-moment thing. There's somebody coming into the room while he's looking at them, and that's, like, because he sees someone coming and he panics and grabs them and then kind of takes them. They're a small note, but... yeah, essentially the premise, this kid steals gym clothes and then is kind of being blackmailed almost by someone else who apparently saw him do it. And it becomes this story for a significant, probably like chunk of like maybe like 10 or so chapters where Nakamura just is kind of forcing him or threatening him to do various kind of depraved acts with a somewhat sexual element to them. With the notion,
somewhat sexual.
Well, some are more sexual than others. I'll state.
It definitely escalates as they go forward.
Well, I don't know. She does start by stripping him at one point. Like, I think that's one of the first ones. Mm-hmm. So, the notion being that she says and believes that he is a pervert deep down. That even though he didn't mean to take the gym clothes, that even though he wants to kind of return them and apologize for it, He really doesn't want to, because deep down he's a pervert, and she's kind of made it a bit of her mission to get him to accept that, because she believes that everyone else around her, they're shitty fake people, they're shitbags, but there's something different when it comes to what's his fucking name?
Casca.
I don't know why that name is like beyond my recognition for remembering. she believes that Casca is a pervert, a depraved person deep down, somebody who would understand that book, someone who would understand the flowers of evil. And that becomes the big element there. But, you know, the story eventually starts to move past that. And that's where I think a lot of the polarization comes from, is because those early chapters, you don't get the sense per se of what this story is going to be about. Like, if you haven't read The Flowers of Evil, which I hadn't, you know, prior to this, and if you don't know what this series is about ultimately, you just see a lot of these very strange, like, uncomfortable acts happening, like, that Nakamura does to Casca. And it can be unnerving to kind of read at points, because she's basically insane and gives no real reason for a lot of the things she does. At the start, you really just have the sense that she's kind of like the Joker, and she just does shit because she feels like it. There doesn't seem to be a rhyme or reason to it, and we only get that kind of explained later on. And that's where I could see a lot of people just dropping this series, because it might just be uncomfortable to see. I mean, there's definitely a lot of, like, sexual assault, uncomfortable amounts of kind of depravity at points. But it's part of the point of the story, but I know that won't be a good enough explanation for some people. So before we even get into the rest of it, that is kind of the point to make, is that there is going to be a section of people that this series is just not for, and that's just something to know going into it. And that's not, you know, as you said, it's not, that's maybe part of the point of what they're kind of going for here, is to weed out maybe the normal quote unquote people. I don't know.
Find all the perverts who are willing to acknowledge what trash bags they are inside. I have complicated feelings about this series, because at first, definitely for the first half of it, I think almost entirely, I was just kind of like, what is wrong with these kids? What is wrong with you? Where are your parents? Oh, there they are, being awful parents. I really feel as though this series relies a bit much on shock value, in order to make its point. The idea of it is, especially in terms of being in line with Baudelaire's style, is to, throw something discomforting at you in order to jar you. And then when that causes you to, you know, kind of let your guard down and expose your soul and open it up to the messages being conveyed and lets you actually stare deep down and stuff. I get that. But it really kind of seems to sacrifice an element of relatability to me. I mentioned some of the other series that we've covered that this one reminded me of. And I talked about, you know, how much I loved, you know, Kurosawa, because it's, although I have never masturbated in a girl's bathroom and been blackmailed as a result of that, a lot of the stuff that did were very relatable for, I think, a lot of people's high school experience. How many people, Chris, do you know of that stole a girl's gym uniform and were blackmailed into doing all sorts of weird stuff, including going on a date with the girl whose gym uniform you stole and wore the gym uniform under their own clothes, and then ran away with the girl that was blackmailing them in order to try to go to the other side of the mountain? Because supposedly the other side of the mountain is where the other side is, and that's where you can go to in order to escape from all of this trash humanity in this horrible town. And then the girl that you have a crush on that you went on a date with while wearing her gym clothes under your clothes tracks you down and follows you. And then in order to get under her skin, the girl that you've run off with tears open your clothing when she catches up with you so that, you know, you're naked and she goes, "He's been wearing your gym clothes underneath this whole time. It's underneath and we're inside where he is." That's fucked up. Okay.
Well, only six if it includes them all wearing the clothes on the date. Otherwise, it's like
no seven, because me,
dirty dozen.
I did that too.
Oh yeah, well yeah, I was including myself in that number.
The reason I'm upset is that they stole my act.
Yeah, so. They were like, "That was my thing. That was classic
stole
Freeman.
My move.
That was classic Freeman." you know, there's a very complicated sort of thing to this. And one thing to stress, this series is very clearly divided into two parts. There is a time skip that...
like a line going through the series.
It greatly kind of changes things. And I'll be very upfront. I think this is a very brilliantly written series at points. And the first part is a very confusing mess. That poses a lot of questions that the second part then answers. Because if you're reading the first part, you're definitely going to say, what's wrong with these kids? Are they right in the way they're thinking? Are they ever going to get better? And that's kind of the purpose of the second part, is that these kids now, 3 years later, at the end of their high school careers, kind of going through their lives now and trying to make some sense of what's happening. And it's significantly more grounded. It deals with a lot more of like a conclusion to elements and things like that. So reading it for the first part is kind of necessary to be confused and kind of like just taken aback by, so that you can kind of get a better sense of things when the second part comes around. But it is a very strange whiplash, because you're like, I forgot that the first part ended with them trying to publicly incinerate themselves at a fair. When you're like, the second part's big drama for a while was like, I want to date this girl, but she's in a relationship. And you're like, what the fuck? This is so normal compared to the other part. But the series has a lot of interesting, complex kind of ways to take a look at things. I think the best way to describe it is, this is not my own words, so I don't want to be said that I'm taking credit for this, but this is actually what the author Oshimi said when he was reading The Flowers of Evil when he was in middle school, what he thought about it. And he said it was, quote, suspicious, indecent, yet nastily noble. And I think that's a very fitting way to describe the first part of this series, because while it is very like kind of gross at points and relies on these shocking moments, there's moments of humanity in there that show that it's not just the shock value and nothing else. There's things beneath that. And that's maybe what kind of helps you stay into the series till you get to that second half. Cause I love the second half. The second half, like, completely shifted my thoughts. But, there's a lot of just interesting parts to kind of discuss on this, cause nothing's straightforward per se. And there's a lot of stuff that's left to you as an audience to kind of decide where you think this actually fits. Like, they never give you an explanation for why Nakamura is the way she is.
Nope.
There's no context provided. There's very little detail provided on her family life.
Well, all that we really know is it seems as though her parents are separate. Well, her parents are separate. Yeah, we know that much.
They're divorced, and she's living with her father at the start of the series.
But both of her parents clearly love her and are at least trying to take care of her. So it doesn't seem to be like an abuse thing.
It's also worth noting, though, that the father makes a mention at least once, maybe even twice, to the fact that Sawa, apparently, is very much like her mother. And the implication maybe being that Sawa's mother was kind of like what Sawa was, and that maybe this is that kind of relationship almost, that she's someone who also just didn't have her head on straight, kind of.
That could be an implication of a hereditary mental condition.
Which is one of the odd things that the series discusses things on a lot of levels, but never brings mental illness into it, which I did think was kind of an unfortunate missing element, because...
Well, we talked about that with a silent voice, too.
Yeah, there was missing in that. But this is a slightly worse level to it, because there's no rational explanation for the way Nakamura acts. Like, there's conditions to her. Like, just flat out, there's no way she'd be just raised to be like that or whatever. And the notion that she could just get better, I mean, she's obviously going to get older, maybe get out of some of those mindsets, but the happiest ending for these characters doesn't involve anyone discussing things with, like, a professional or getting, like, help in case there's chemical imbalances.
They just need to get into a wrestling match on the beach, and then they're fine.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's the one part that I thought was missing from this story, but I understand maybe it would have brought up too much into the story, since it's mostly meant to be a story that deals with the themes of who we are as adolescents and then who we become.
Yeah, and I do think that if you go into, like, bringing more science and hard logic into things, then it does kind of corrupt the feel of the series as a whole. You mentioned that there's the tremendous difference between the two halves of the series. And I'm there with you in terms of the second half definitely changed my feelings on the series as a whole. Because as I was wrapping up the first one, I was basically like thinking that I had already kind of settled on my feelings for the series, which was, it does some interesting and memorable things, but it just kind of seems to be doing shocking things for the sake of shock. And really kind of being up its own ass with the way that the kids are acting and being dismayed over the way the world is and that they don't fit in and stuff. They do basically as the contract goes along. At first, Kasuga is entirely reluctant to go along with what Sawa is doing. And he's incredibly tempted to just confess, and get everything out in the open and just kind of face the music. But he's, you know, a coward. You know, he's still a kid. You know, he's very afraid of the consequences of what's going to happen. And most importantly, how Seiki is going to respond to, you know, learning that about him. As he gets drawn more and more deeper into, the contract with Sawa, he gets more into it. There's a big scene where Sawa has him just return the gym clothes to the class and then confess on the board. And then she's like, you have more to confess, don't you? Like, that's not all there is. And he just lets everything out after being pushed through everything he has. He confesses to everything. He just goes on and on, writing all over the board. He takes out like inkbrushes and paints all over the walls and the floor. He's just going completely nuts, letting everything out. And he completely, fully acknowledges what a dirtbag he is deep down, the darkness inside of him, and this evil, writhing thing that he's dealing with, and acknowledges that that's who he is. And of course, all the ink that he's streaked across the walls has covered up his name for the confession. when people check on it the next day. So he's still in the clear. But Seiki knows that it's him because she recognizes a symbol that he's drawn from Le Fleur de Mal because they've talked about the book and that was how they ended up going on the date. But it turns out Seiki is even more screwed up in the head than either Sawa or Kasuga.
When she first kind of confronts him about it, this was where the series took its first twist in the right direction for me. Because they give actually a legitimate character to Seiki, who to that point had been the beautiful idol girl in school who everybody admires and she works really hard. But she then explains, like, I don't care that you stole my gym clothes. I want to know who you are because I never felt like people understand me and I want to understand you. And I was like, this seems like an interesting way to take this. It's a mature kind of idea. It's like recognizing that the gym clothes thing is kind of like a non-issue after like a while. And she really expressed that even while she didn't understand the Flowers of Evil, she tried to read it for his sake. She didn't get it, but she wants to understand him so that she can then, comprehend what he's like. She's not doing it judgmentally. She just earnestly wants to know who he is. And I was like, okay, this series is kind of like this weird tragedy where Kasuga is always one step away from becoming a better person, and then Nakamura, like, forces into some more like, depraved shit for no reason. Yeah. But then that sort of changes in the second half of part one or whatever you'd call it, where Kasuga puts in the contract with Nakamura, and that's where I kind of got lost on the series for a bit. It delved really hard into the most of the kids becoming very lost to any sense of sanity. They start doing more and more profane, just horrid, lewd acts.
They set up a hut in the middle of, like, this swamp, basically, just on the outskirts of town. And Kasuga and Sawa are stealing clothes and belongings from all the girls in their class, you know, and just hanging them up in the hut. And Kasuga's doing all of this for Sawa's sake because he's obsessed with this idea of helping her to find her place because they couldn't get to the other side of the mountain. They were stopped, so he has to make her place here instead. But inevitably, as Kasuga gets more and more obsessed with helping Sawa in this way, he becomes distanced from Seiki, and Seiki is upset by this because now he won't show her who he is. He's just obsessed more with Sawa. So in a jealous rage, she ends up burning the hut down, and
yeah, that's where I kind of really started. I don't get really what happened in that entire span. It just seemed unnecessary. But there's aspects that pop in during that, because it becomes almost cartoonish at times. There's point, literally, where Nakamura comes into... I'm going to forget his name no matter how many times I fucking
remember. Kasuga.
I don't know why. Like, it just doesn't make sense to me. It's not a name. I'm going to call him Kenny.
You can also call him Taco.
I don't know. She goes to Kasuga's house and literally breaks his father's leg with a baseball bat.
Yeah.
Before stealing the kid. Like, it's such a weird moment when you look at the whole
context.
And
they run away together in order to try and go behind the mountain.
It's very strange in that way. But the thing that I like in these moments is... there's moments when these kids, even though they really don't get themselves, but they have these moments of, like, earnesty with themselves. Like, there's a scene, I think it's chapter 17, where, Kasuga, it's when they're on that mountain road, and he's just like, I'm afraid to get close to Seiki, because I have trouble seeing her as a human, because I've always valued her as a goddess from afar. So I'm afraid of getting to know her as a person. And I'm afraid Nakamura is going to discover when she tries to dig down and find this darker side of me that there isn't one and that I'm just hollow on the inside. And he, like, acknowledges, like, I read Flowers of Evil, but I really didn't totally get it. I just saw that it was talking about how the other people didn't get it. Yeah, basically, it's like, I mentioned how other people didn't get it and I thought that I understood it, but now I'm realizing I don't. And there's another moment then, I think it's, like, right before they have that festival, where Nakamura kind of boldly states, like, she's like, I know there's no other side. Like, I recognize we're not actually different from them so much. There's not another side. There's just, we're slightly better than they are. The way they phrase it is they want to get to the other side so they can get away from these shitty people, but they realize they're shitty people too. They're just facing another direction than everybody else. That's their kind of way of explaining it. And though they don't fully get out of the fact, like, they're like, wow, holy shit, maybe we're just too emotional as teenagers, like, too many hormones going on for us to, like, be making sound decisions.
This is too much to deal with. Let's just go set ourselves on fire.
Yeah. At least they acknowledge that part of their explanation for why they're doing things is bullshit. Like, it's not like Air Gear where everything's about the wings of friendship and fucking all that shit. They don't buy into all the shit they're spewing completely. So, I appreciate those parts of it, and there were some interesting elements early on that weren't explored that kind of had me intrigued as well. Because one question you'd ask is, like, are these kids ever going to get better? And there's kind of, like, a side answer waiting for you in the case of Kasuga's dad. Because Kasuga's dad also enjoys the same books. He reads all the same poetry, everything like that. And you're like, he's like a normal dude at the house right now. So, like, it seems weird that he's not talked to his kid on anything like that. He's a decent dad. Like, he goes out of his way to protect his son. And even after he's, like, put up in the hospital with a fucking broken leg, like, when the dad comes to apologize, like, no time. The kids are going to do some crazy shit. We'll save them.
Yeah.
Like, I appreciate that. But it's one of those things where you're wondering, like, are they going to do something with this? Or is this just meant for, as a reader, for you to be like, oh, there's an example out there in the future. They kind of make that a bit more strange later on because they just have the dad develop, like, alcoholism and a smoking habit and laziness that only gets cured when his son finally gets better. But yeah, it's just like, okay, I guess he's just not going to drink anymore. But I do appreciate that there's a lot of elements to the story that when you think about it, they aren't going to be explicitly stated for you, but if you think about them, you can get new context for things. That said, the series is very dumb at times, too. When I saw this, I could not stop laughing for a moment. This is the first chapter of the time skip, when everything moves on to its next part. And this is after one of the most emotionally heavy chapters to this point. Probably the most to this point. And we see Kasuga in his new school. He's in a new town.
He's got with a long bunch hair of, now.
Yeah, he's got long hair. And he's hanging out with a group of other boys because he doesn't really have much of a purpose in life, but he's going with emotions. And this group of teenage boys are having a conversation about the size, like, which size of breasts is the best. And,
yeah.
And one boy says that small chested girls are the best because they know that they have a quote unquote flaw, and that nuance is actually what defines and gives them sexuality and attractiveness. And that layer is what gives them sexual depth. And I said that I'm like, this manga just stated its fucking theme through an analogy about breast sizes. And I can't decide if it is the most stupid thing I've ever heard or if I'm like, no, that makes perfect sense for this series to explain it that way. Like, you sit there like, are we really having this conversation in this way? All right.
Flawed humans are perfect because...
And, like, look, it explores this topic in a lot of different ways that I enjoy. The big element of part two that makes it a little bit better is that a new girl gets introduced, Takawa, and she kind of embodies...
Takawa, but close enough.
Takawa, whatever. T-person. And she,
T-Pain.
Yeah, T-Pain, T-Dog.
She, yo, real fucked in the head.
she's a person who kind of lies a little bit between the two love interests of last time, where she has a deeper level to her, like Nakamura, but she is a lot more grounded than Nakamura as well. And she's basically the element introduced in the series that sort of helps facilitate, Kasuga improving himself and then kind of escaping this rut. And there's a lot of important steps that go through that are really rewarding to see. You know, Kasuga earning his way up to this point is not an easy journey, and there's not necessarily a fully happy ending for him. One of the most brutal moments is when his grandfather dies. He has to go back to that town to kind of be there, and his entire family just blames him for everything that's happened.
Yeah.
And
it's honestly a really effective moment because at that point, because Casca has actually been getting healthier and improving, because even though they move away from this town in order to get away from all the, you know, judgmental stares and all that stuff, when move away, the relationship between Casca and his parents is still really strained because, as his mother put it, "I can't believe I raised a kid who turned out like this. What the hell does that say about me as a parent?"
Yeah.
But after he meets Tequila, he strikes a bond with her because she's also really into books. She's also into writing. And Casca, after a bit of time with her, and it's a much more grounded stretch of the series because they start hanging out and bonding over this. And her older boyfriend is really good at hiding it at first, but he's clearly jealous of how close Tequila is to and Casca are. And when he starts acting like a dick, she calls him on it, and that only drives them really closer together. And eventually, Casca, like, actually gets the nuts together to just flat out realize that he really likes her, and he asks her out. And it's a huge step forward for him because the other women that he was clearly had a sexual attraction to for one reason or another were because he admired them, at, like you said, as idols. And whereas he is bonded to her as a person, that connection is far healthier. So he improves and he has this big breakthrough. And so he just goes home one day and all the other interactions with his parents thus far have been him being very distant from them, not really talking about what he's doing, not listening when they scold him for staying out late. And he just says to them, "Hey, mom, dad, I'm home." And they immediately realize what this means for him and they're happy together again. So they have that huge breakthrough and are together as a family again. It's a really nice moments and it a big payoff, and then they go home and of course their outer family still hate him, and they go back because his dad's father, his grandfather, is on his deathbed, and when they get back there, everyone still hates Casca, and they're like, grandpa didn't want to see you, he didn't want you to come back. You're to blame for him actually not being able to hold on anymore and dying.
You're the shame of our family. Everyone has been ashamed from what you've done. And you've actually caused a rift in the family because they also imply that the father doesn't keep in contact with that side of the family much anymore. That they've kind of grown distant since then. And he doesn't get forget. Like, he apologizes earnestly about it. Like, he truly seems to be sorry for everything that happened. They don't forgive him, though. They don't really care.
You know, it's dealing with the consequences in a very real way, which is, you know, he gets past it and improves as a person. He does all that he can, but it's never all going to be completely wrapped up in a nice little bow. There are people that he makes amends with through the whole thing, but there are some that he never really gets better with, including Seiki. He runs into Seiki later on. And she has clearly not really gotten better. She's dating a guy who, it's explicitly noted by Tequila, looks a lot like Casca. So she's still unhealthily obsessed with him and is not better.
Yeah.
And they end up going off on their own to like eat dinner together, and she's being this catty bitch the whole time.
It's interesting. There's a definite kind of point to the story of exploring purpose and what people's purpose is. That's kind of the whole, the other side thing Nakamura kept talking about. She was really trying to find a purpose in everything, and Casca was searching for purpose by trying to find her other half. They're all looking for something to give themselves meaning.
Right. And they think that they can find it in other people when that's not the right way to do it.
And the end of the story kind of reached this point where none of these characters have an answer. But they're at different stages of it. You acknowledge Seiki, like, we don't know what happens to her per se. We don't see her again after that point.
Well, we see her reuniting with her friend.
That's a dream.
You're right.
Yeah, a dream that was kind of comically optimistic about things.
Optimistic, yeah.
So
it ends on a weird note because Casca has a dream of two possible futures. One in which he basically goes back to Sawa and they continue their unhealthy relationship together. And the other, which everything turns out super awesome great because he stays with Tokiwa. And then when he wakes up, it seems as though he's trying to pursue the happy ending, at the least.
Yeah.
That's about it.
The very ending goes to suggest Kasuga has maybe found some manner of purpose for him. Because, as I said, he gets better. He's become a better person, but he still hasn't found purpose. He's still kind of just going forward with life and living a happy life, a good relationship with Tokiwa. And what happens in the last couple chapters is she says, like, you should write too. You have a lot of these stories. He's like, I'm not as good as you are at writing anything like that. And she kind of puts up there, like, you know, you might want to give it a try. And we get the sense that maybe him starting to write is his first chance to kind of express himself publicly more. And this could start moving him towards the idea of finding some sort of purpose in life. So we get an impression there, but that is sort of a defining thing. The ending is very much an ambiguous sort of thing of, you don't know which one of these two ways is meant to be what would ultimately happen. There's a somewhat of a dark insinuation. The flower of evil is an actual element of the story. It appears kind of at points when Kasuga is in his darkest points, when he's going in the path with Sawa, basically. And the flower appears in his dream at the end. And there's a level of worry that you might have that does that suggest he's not moved on from Sawa and he's never going to fully get out of that? Or is this maybe a good interpretation of that because it follows a good dream where he sees how much happier, including Sawa, everyone else is if he doesn't go back to her? You know, there's weird elements to it. And there's a lot to kind of pull in, especially if you they go with the idea that Sawa's mother was like her. We get to see that Sawa's mother at this point seems to be a content person, so
yeah, she runs her own little business. The people who are frequent clients there seem to really get along with her.
Yeah,
so yeah,
yeah. She mentions too that she's like, "Hey, like if you guys could leave, that'd be great." Sawa is calm right now, like she's in this place. So
she's better than she was when you guys were around. So can you just
Can you fuck off? She hasn't been beating anyone with baseball bats or anything.
And Sawa doesn't want to see him at first. Because she's kind of in the same boat there. But it's something that Kasuga kind of, like, determines needs to happen. They need to, like, at least have one last discussion. And it's not a very pleasant discussion.
No.
They just, they end up getting into a big fight, but it somehow turns into a play fight at the end. I'm not really sure exactly how that transition happens, but it at least gives you the clarity that these two are at least in a better place than they were when they were actually together. So
yeah, the sort of end element of it is Sawa basically saying, "Go on, Kasuga, you're a normal person," and sort of like washing herself, like washing him of any need to be reliant on the things that happened between the two of them. There's still a bleakness to that because it just insinuates that somehow she's not going to ever escape that world or whatever, but you don't know how much of that she actually is involved in because this is the only time we've seen her since then, and it's also when Kasuga's around. But there's definitely a lot of discussion and interpretation you can put onto things, and that's appreciated. This is definitely a series that has quality writing to it that leaves the audience with a chance to make their own interpretation of things, because not very much is ever explicitly stated. No one ever calls out Nakamura, for example, for the fact that she continuously accuses Kasuga of being a pervert and, like, all these depraved things he's doing as a kid when we have no evidence any of those happened. But you still have the leeway to say, like, well, even though we don't have proof, doesn't mean they didn't happen. We may just not have seen them actively happened or anything like that. So there's aspects I enjoy that, because you can take out of it what you want. And the ending helps to get these characters in a better place. The good ending is maybe a little too happy, but I was legitimately touched when we see Sawa reconnecting with her dad, because you just see her looking to him and he looks so happy to see her. I'm like, that's nice. It's very sweet to have that. And you do want the best to kind of come for these characters, because their worst crime is being a kid, basically. Being a teenager just has no control over their life. But I enjoyed the series a lot. But I also acknowledge this is not going to be a series for everybody. The best way I could describe the first part of it is it feels very reminiscent to a Chuck Palahniuk book, which are series that kind of rely a lot on shock value, but don't have as much substance underneath. This one thankfully has a little bit of it to hold on to, but, it's one of those things you relate to a lot more when you're younger. And then when you get older, you're like, why the fuck did I like Fight Club that much? It's not that good.
I'd have to go back and watch that again. It's been
the movie might play a little bit differently than the books, but
It does. So,
yeah.
Like I said, I felt like I had reached my conclusion on what this series was to me after I completed the first half, and then the second half changed it for me. The second half, I think, is a much, much better, and not just because it clarifies and recontextualizes and provides answers for the first part. I think it's just, like, more interesting, the stuff, and more relatable and easier to get into than the first half. And not just because of the shock value stuff, because it seems a lot more human. And I feel like it was a lot easier to get into the story, and not just of, you know, Casca finding himself after the shit that he'd been through, but to Kiwa. I really do like the relationship that the two of them have and the way that they, and I don't know, the story of Casca's redemption isn't quite the right word, but that's basically the best one I can think of. It's a lot more interesting than that of his downfall. And I feel as though if we're going to judge in terms of what the story was trying to specifically do, I think that it's a little bit uneven. It doesn't carry that idea of, you know, what the darker side of humanity does especially well. The note that you made about the ending where, in his dream, Casca sees the flower of evil and he's shown the two possibilities indicates to me that, you know, that darkness is always going to be inside of him. And that's fine. You know, people are always going to have dark evil urges. It's what we choose to actually do in order to deal with those urges that defines who we are as people. And so, and leaving it on that ambiguous note of him picking up the pencil and starting to write, is he going to be the obsessed author, or is he just going to complete a book that Tokiwa likes and they're going to get married and have kids and everyone's going to get together? You know, you don't know. It's probably going to be somewhere in between. But in terms of actually dealing with all that stuff, I feel as though the second half I like a lot more because it deals with the real world consequences of what you do when you just choose to follow those urges. It's not a very internally focused section. It's an externally focused section. The internally focused section was where I thought it was a mess and I didn't really like it. So, overall, I came away from this liking it, but again, in terms of comparing it to those series that I mentioned before, I liked all three of those more than I liked this one.
I think the really key difference is those series, well, maybe not Homunculus. I'd have to go back and read Homunculus. That was a really long time
Homunculus,
ago.
Homunculus in terms of how it dealt with the imagery and the, you know, that internal darkness and stuff like that, was much more consistent all the way through.
Yeah,
so.
Well, that was like a point of it too. It was like purposely macabre, whereas this one's just kind of gross at times. But in comparison to like Onani Master Kurosawa and that, those are earnest series that are trying to tell the story of a kid who makes a mistake and learns to be a better person as a result of it. That's not explicitly the point of this because it's more about. It's the name of the book. The book is, the manga series is, Aku no Hana. It's about the flowers of evil. It's about that book. It's about, depravity and, grossness, combined with sexuality
what
and adolescence.
Darkness and evil.
Exactly. Yeah. And it carries that story through a story similar to something like Onani Mazda Kurosawa. That's the ultimate point I kind of got out of it, is it's an exploration of that. And some of the flaws I see are possibly explained as being intentional to explore things on that nature more. Because, as I said, the second part really feels like an answer to the first, which is what feels like probably the Flowers of Evil is, where it's just a lot of, like, crazy shit happen, like evil, dark, love, sex, deathness.
Right.
The second part's like a grounded response to it, like you'd kind of have when you get older, and you're like, why did I read this? This is so weird. And like, throw it over your shoulder.
I didn't understand this book at all.
This is nonsense. But man, did I...
I don't know French.
But man, did I underestimate that third Linkin Park album. Minutes to Midnight's amazing, guys. It doesn't stop with the hits. But yeah, I don't want
to... I've got inverted feelings on Minutes to Midnight. I think the first half is great and the second half is kind of boring.
We were so close on connecting today, and then I'm going to fight Nick. I just wanted to say, like, I think this series does have flaws to it, but I think this series has been one of the more interesting ones we've discussed, just because there's a lot of elements to bring up. There's a lot of parts of what we haven't even discussed.
Yeah.
A lot of imagery, a lot of great themes, a lot of symbolism that's really just cool to see.
Small but important role that Kinoshita plays.
Yeah. but yeah, that's Akinada. I should note, if you guys want to check this out, it is actually available. It's been translated to English. All the volumes are out. You can pick them up. I call the series Akinohana because it's based off of a book that's the same name. So I just call it by the Japanese name to distinguish. But in America, or in English, it is translated bluntly to The Flowers of Evil. So you can check it out. I think Amazon, yeah, digitally, and pick it up in bookstores too. So if you're curious, go check it out.
Or you can check out the anime adaptation, which is, I think, still available through Crunchyroll. It's very bizarre, though, because it's rotoscoped. So be aware of that.
It also only covers the first, like, bit of the series, doesn't it? It doesn't get to the
end. Really? It doesn't go into the conclusion?
I don't think so. I think it got canceled. At least that's what I thought I read. I might have been wrong on that, though, but,
And then they tried to set themselves on fire, but they failed. The end!
I think it literally, well, it doesn't get to that point, but it ends, with him discovering her journal, I believe. So, like, the diary when he makes the contract with her. So, yeah, you don't actually get to see the whole series if you follow the anime, unfortunately.
All right. Let's go on to the regular recap portion with the manga recap. We got a lot of series to go through, so I think that we're gonna try and maintain a relatively high pace this time. Relatively. My Hero Academia, we're gonna start things off with number 149, Don't Get Mad, Erinaka, which deals with Erinaka being mad.
Now, Nick, if I could start a quick wrestling tangent, real quick.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding.
SummerSlam was mostly awful, so,
I'm like, I don't get it. Nakamura's characters, he has random orgasms at times, seems weird.
So, we actually begin this chapter with a flashback to when Toga and Twice were meeting with the Yakuza, in order to throw in with them and, you know, offer their support and such. Erinaka was clearly suspicious of them from the start, really didn't like them, as evidenced by his little miniature form, having large bug eyes, but as we've seen from him before, he seems to have quite a quick temper when it comes to the villain Malayan, so this is normal for him. Especially because Toga flat out says, like, we've agreed to help you, Eyes. We still don't like you, so, you know.
Yeah.
Then we get very explicit explanations of their powers. Like, they go into extreme detail. Each of them gets basically a full page to explain all the stuff that they can do. And Twice shares some important details, like, I don't know if we ever actually saw the tape measure that he's got, in his wrist of his costume. But he says that he actually has to understand something before copying it. He's got to have a very clear image of it, and he's got to, you know, measure the shoe size. Essentially, he's got to do the full, you know, measuring you for a tux thing before he can properly copy you. And then once he can do that, he can do that. And also he can make a few number of clones, and he just kind of says vaguely, although of course we know the reason, and for personal reasons, I can't clone myself. After that, Toga also says, like, yeah, and I can transform into a person when I drink their blood. I can transform into a few different people if I drink their blood all at once. Also, I have to get naked in order to transform their clothes. Otherwise, I'll just have these clothes on top of the clothes that I transform. Fair enough. Most of it's confirming stuff that we already know, although the stuff about twice is, having to measure stuff is an interesting detail thrown in there.
The suggestion also seems to be that the member behind Hisaki has some sort of power to force the truth out of people, because both Twice and Toga kind of react to, like, why did I just say that?
Yeah. He just kind of, like, has this glowing aura around him when he says that. And also although I don't know about that, because he then asks them, did you hear anything from Shigaraki about betraying us? And they're like, no.
Yeah, that might be a wording thing, though, of a sense of, like, they don't have an explicit plan to betray them as much as they have a plan to just be shitheads, like, to just cause chaos, I guess. There are notions, like, they're working with them and against them at the same time. I don't know. That's my implication, the suggestion I get from it, but it's not explicitly stated.
Irinaka then really... It's funny that he continues to maintain his little miniature form while he's trying to intimidate them. He's like, I'm going to crush you guys if you dare try and betray us. When his real form is this jacked muscle dude in suspenders.
Actually, B. Patnod brought up a point. Quirks do have flaws and weaknesses. Maybe he can't tell it if you both speak at the same time because they both answer at the same time. So maybe if that happens, you can't.
Or maybe they're so crazy it doesn't work.
A very realistic possibility.
I don't know. So I'm sure that we'll probably, if that is the case, that there was some sort of truth zone in effect, then I'm sure that we'll get it. I thought that it was just that Twice just launched into it because... He's got the split personality thing, so he tries to deny it at first, and then the other side of him takes over, and he explains it anyway.
I thought it too, but then I wasn't sure what Toga's reaction afterwards was supposed to be.
She says, now I just look dumb. So I thought that she was just following up because he bothered to explain it.
I meant her reaction after her explanation, where I was like, why are you nervous about the fact you talked about you getting naked when you chose to do so? Like, no one you could have just said I turned into people.
Hmm. I don't know. So we cut back to the present after Irinaka in the past said, I'll crush you guys if you dare to betray us, to him trying to betray, to crush them for betraying them. We get some, you know, stuff of Twice and Toga continuing to be like, you're a shithead to Irinaka, until the heroes finally take action because Toga points out, you know, the wimpier the guy, the more he tries to hide himself in his weakness. The more he tries to look strong, also he can look down on others. You guys are so uncool. And she just looks straight up into the ceiling to where there's a tunnel very obviously carved out in the wall so that Irinaka can stare down at all of his prey while he's trying to crush them from above. And Deku catches on to this and springs up through the tunnel, bouncing back and forth, and smashing into Irinaka's hiding spot so that he falls down from above. And now that he's fallen down, he can't merge with anything because he's just falling through the sky. And Twice is just like, oh, bye, see ya, asshole. And then Night Eye takes him out with one of his little weights, knocks him square in the jaw and knocks him out. And that's basically it. Irinaka has been defeated. And now we are cutting away from there because we have to catch up with Mirio, who has come across Overhaul and another of Overhaul's goons. And that's it. So, yeah. Irinaka's been taken out and slowly the bullets are being chipped away.
That seems. I guess we just have, like, what, one left or something?
There were the three, and then Irinaka's four, and then Barrier Guy and Rappa.
And I think one's fighting the girls, right? out front, right, like one charge right. through.
So I guess that the last guy is the guy in the hood that's with Overhaul, maybe? I can't remember the two-page spread that we got, so.
Yeah, should be interesting.
Yeah. It was nice to see Deku get to contribute after a little while, because we haven't really seen him in action very much because so much else has been going on.
True. I think I must have stepped away for that part, but special acknowledgement to Twice for, and actually, I guess Horikoshi for confirming that Mag was a trans character and kind of sticking up for
yeah.
her.
Yeah, because no one was willing in the, Hoskai was willing to acknowledge that they referred to as Big Sis Mag as opposed to Big Bro Mag.
Yeah. So much appreciated, although it is somewhat unfortunate that the best representation of trans characters is a dead character. But still, it's nice to see that like level of progressiveness in a manga series. They don't tend to have that very frequently.
Okay. Alright, so that is it for My Hero Academia. Let's move on to Astra, Lost in Space! Last time we got the bombshell that the kids are not from the planet Earth, they're from the planet Astra, which was a pretty big shock for Paulina, who is from Earth. Yeah, so we get a follow-up to this whole thing, after they've made sure that they are on course going through hyperspace to have a discussion of things. And Paulina is up on a map of the Astra planet, and it's like, okay, what do you call this landmass? Like, well, it's called this. It's that continent, it's this continent. And Paulina is thinking, like, okay, it's not Earth. Even the continents are shaped differently, so what's going on? And Charles is just like, well, of course it's not your home planet. It's our home planet, so of course they'd be different. What are you talking about? But, of course, Luca's like, well, then why the hell does she speak the same language we do? Like, come on, we're incredibly similar. To which Kanata says, well, maybe she's a space alien. It's like, we've already concluded that. She is an alien to us. Yes, she's from a different planet.
It's like, well, thank God you're here, Kaneda, to always provide us with some comic relief in the worst of times.
Yeah, and he's like, what if she's a space alien shapeshifter that's morphed into a human? No! No, you're wrong. So, Paulina brings up, this is really weird, you know, I'm speaking English with you guys, but actually, though, see, my native language is Russian. I'm from Russia. Have you guys ever heard of that? And Ares brings up, it was what was called a country, right? And Zach's like, oh yes, an outdated means of geopolitical organization that no longer exists. See, in the future world of the 25th century, where the Federation is formed, we have moved beyond such trifles among humanity, and we are all just one people that live together in harmony.
Do they have lightsabers? I'm not going to care if they don't have lightsabers, Nick. You're all just fucking space congress at that point.
You have
point.
To fight against the replicants. So, let's see here. Ares brings up, oh, you know, you mentioned Russia. There is an area right around there that used to be called, I think, the Soviet Union. The plan's like, well, what about that? Yeah, that was the United States of America. And we find out basically from this that Ares, in addition to having photographic memory, seems to have a little bit of an expertise in history. So she's identifying, yeah, that used to be, you know, China, that used to be Japan, that used to be India. And, Paulina realizes, okay, she's roughly correct. Even though the planets are different, the areas that she is pointing out are, I guess, approximately where the countries could be. And so we get a discussion of history montage, of just, you know, everyone sitting around, like, they're going over their own versions of history and trying to find, common patterns and then where that diverges. And eventually, Paulina just brings up, hey, so you guys are really having difficulty kind of piecing some of this together. Don't you guys take history classes in school? And Charles is like, well, we do have history courses, but they don't go any earlier than the modern era. That's real helpful, isn't it? Like, yes, our society is all about looking ahead to the future instead of dwelling on the past. I have so many teachers that would be furious at this revelation.
We don't need to learn anything from the past. We're far too important in the future.
It is amazing, just like the such obvious conspiracy going on. We don't want you to know anything older than 40 years ago, okay? Like, it's not important.
When did your American history start? For some reason, nothing past the Berlin Wall going down. I don't... What do you... World War...
What happened there?
What Nazi?
God. It's... Just mind-boggling that they've been so programmed this way. Like, for a society that seems to be about scientific advancement, doesn't seem to really go on the idea of, you know, learning through observation.
Well, we kind of find out going forward that essentially, what we thought was like, oh, they're just from a different Earth is not necessarily the case. They're actually from an alternate Earth. Because in that world, the world that all the kids are from, World War III happened. The Cuban Missile Crisis did not. World War III happened instead. And presumably those chain of events is kind of what led humanity. Well, they stated, that's what kind of led humanity to start exploring other worlds because they fucked up too much of Earth in that nuclear holocaust, basically.
Well, they implied that, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, but then it turned into World War III.
Yeah. The idea that it didn't get solved, I should say, or ceasefire, whatever. Mm-hmm.
And Pauline is like, no, this is impossible, you know, in the history that I know of, you know, we averted that disaster. And so everyone realized from this, like, okay, so everything was the same up until this point when there was this divergence. This is the juncture. And Ulgar says, well, yeah, everybody learns about World War III because, you know, it's actually just common knowledge. So presumably this was kind of, you know, a really big deal that this actually happened. If a society that doesn't bother learning about history past the modern era does learn about this event. And, so Pauline is, you know, like, oh my God, you know, there's this all out crisis, and she starts to pray. And Kanata's just like, you should say God.
What is God?
What is God? Can you tell me, Paulina, what is love?
It's the moment I had to start laughing because I was like, this is starting to get kind of dumb. When it's like, what is your God you speak of? And I'm like, shouldn't this be the other way around at this point? Like, I feel it's weird that the cast of characters we've grown to know are the ones who are like not having their worlds rocked right now.
So Paulina from this is like, then in this point in the world, I guess there's no religion now too. Okay, all right, let's go over what happened next in history. And so they go over the fallout and, you know, nuclear fallout and stuff like that. And eventually the world was so horribly raised that they were like, okay, yeah, this is a mistake. And they go from like, yeah, in 1962 there was World War III, and in 1963 the United World Government was founded. It's like, that happened quickly. All out nuclear war would fuck us up really fast. There you go. So even every, you know, government was abolished. You know, like everything complete peace was accomplished. All guns were taken away. Oh no, America would be so sad. The walls that had separated people were torn down. Humanity came together as it had ever had before with the aid of Mara technology. Rebuilt society at incredible speed after the great sacrifice of World War III. This time humanity succeeded in building a new, unified, and peaceful world. And this year the world is getting ready to celebrate the centennial anniversary of its unification. So, it's 2163. History is very different. And Pauline's like, okay, got it, but why did this actually diverge? Did the divergence happen? Actually, is there any guarantee that all that actually happened? Because, you know, like, with this history stuff, is it... All right, guys, hey, You said that there weren't any history books before, so what do you call a book? And Ares is like, this is a book. He basically just pulls out a Kindle. Fair enough. But no, like, you know, an analog book with paper and stuff. It's like, paper books? What is book? What is God?
So, like, look, I'm out of time for this, so everybody, I'll just start explaining to save your questions to the end. Paulina, what is a question? Like,
we must find this question.
They're like, oh, you know what? Fuck it. Just, I'm going to jump out the airlock. I don't even care anymore.
And I thought you kids were smart. Jesus.
Yeah.
Who is Jesus?
Although, to be fair, this might actually truly be actually just one reality, because I don't think kids today have seen paper books either.
Well, there you go. But so she's like, okay, well, then maybe they actually eliminate all books, which could very well be, you know, part of the effort to eliminate past history for some reason. So they're like, okay, then, Lena, why don't you tell us what happened in your history? And Pauline's like, yeah, sure, fine. And, so she's like, okay, so in 1962, there's a Cuban Missile Crisis, blah, blah, blah. We avoided disaster there. Eventually it ended, and the world entered the age of terrorism. Yes, that's about right. But then a new unprecedented threat appeared that made all human squabbles utterly insignificant by comparison. An asteroid was discovered in 2049. It was enormous, and by all calculations, it was guaranteed to crash into Earth 8 years later in 2057. Approximately 3 kilometers across, unimpacted by a body that big, would wipe out all life on the planet. And all the kids were like, what? That can't be true! God!
Hold on, wait. Slow down, Polly. What's Russia? Like we got over that like 10 minutes. Fuck you. No, Kanata, you don't get questions anymore. What's I already told you what a question is.
So Paulina says, so therefore, humanity literally had only one option because we could not avoid the asteroid crashing into the Earth. We had to take all of Bikini Bottom and push it somewhere else.
Push.
That's a great fucking episode.
That's a classic.
And everyone's like, that's literally impossible. And she's like, it would be, but not if you used an artificial wormhole. And Kanata's like, artificial wormhole? I do know what that is! Because they realized that that's what transported them to the Astra from the planet Astra at the start of the series. So, this last part was a twist that I did, a revelation that I called happening last time we discussed Astra. All the stuff about the diverging history is obviously stuff that we didn't predict, and it was rather shocking to have it all laid out like that. It's interesting stuff, and it's going to be interesting to see what the hell happened here, because the idea that we kind of had was that, or the theory that at least I was working off of, was that Lena was from a time before humanity had to pick up and move like this, and they had just moved from Earth to Astra, and we now get this idea that that didn't happen. So, is it that the kids have been lied to about history? Is it that there actually is a parallel Earth? What's going on?
Yeah, I was like, if this is an alternate universe then how did Paulina's crew get here? Because they're not, like, they noted they're headed towards Astra, which doesn't exist in her timeline, so I'm not sure.
Was there some sort of calamitous event that caused a dimensional shift?
They're like, no, fucking Flash ran really fast, just messed some shit up. I'm like, oh, god damn you, Flash!
Damn it, Wally!
Stop trying to save your mom, it doesn't work!
Oh, sorry, not Wally. I'm assuming, has Wally shown up in the Flash TV show?
Yeah.
Wally West?
Yeah, he's in there now.
Is he like Kid Flash?
Yeah. He's also like a mechanic or something. I don't know. It was really dumb. I stopped watching Flash. It got me too angry.
Has he messed up as many times as Barry has?
No, because Barry's still like season four. He's still trying to fucking save his mom. I know it's like the third time.
How many seasons of the show have there been?
three. And I think he's tried to save his mom at least 3 different times and had to let her die twice. Specifically, I had to let her die because it's like, wasn't you have to learn the lesson that you can't fuck with time.
Wasn't this like the only good part of that terrible time machine movie from 2005 that you can't change the past sometimes?
Well, they haven't learned that yet in Flash, so.
Alright. that's it for Astra. I'm gonna move on to Food Wars now. Shokugeki no Soma, chapter 227. We just had all of the dishes presented at once for the judges and the, second round of the Team Shokugeki. So, up first are the resistance group. We got Mimasaka and, Megashima, sorry. And, I almost called him Subaru. I think I almost called him Subaru. Mimasaka and Subaru. There's two of them because you can copy.
So yeah, there's two. Yep.
Yeah. And Kuga. Results of the second bout is the name of the chapter. It's where we get the results of the second bout. Spoilers. So they go over the resistances group first, and we get, you know, it's a pretty straightforward reacting to tasty food for the first bit of it. The male judges are up first. They get hit with explosions, head on, and, their clothes fly off because they're blown off by the tastiness of Kuga's dish, a barrage of flavor. Yes. They also have a much milder reaction to, Mimasaka's. No clothes come off for that one, but they talk about how great it is, and there is a breakdown of the components of his, last sushi roll. Then we get to, Megishima's with his African ramen thing. And there's red pepper and they're like, there's no sign of the red pepper in the noodles or broth. Where is it? It's like, it's harissa. It's a seasoning that goes on. Okay, cool. And they're like, oh, it's so delicious. Female judge is like, there go my clothes.
I'm drunk now.
She says specifically, wee hee hee, that was so nummy, I'm even drunker now. And everyone's like, how is that possible?
I like when the other cast is just like, what? Why would it do that?
And Hisaka's like, that's not important. yeah. But, there's something that she notes, which is like, hey, you know, there's something that's worthy of attention here, regarding Kuga's dish. The sublime taste experience wasn't created using solely Chinese cooking techniques. It chose an equally deft use of traditional French techniques. And, Kuga's like, yes, the sweet and sour sauce. It was based on sauce au vinaigre balsamic. I'm sure that I pronounced that as horribly as I could. Good for me. And, yeah, so they're like, oh, yes, it's very good. And Rindo's like, Kuga did French stuff. That's cool. And she's just gonna,
she's like, neat.
Basically. And everyone in the cage is like, yeah, we can do this. Yeah. And Kuga says, from the day Suka-san beat the stuffing out of me until right now, I've been wrestling with myself, fighting to change my cooking. If today I'd been the same chef trapped by my old cooking, I'd never have been able to scrape together a dish with green tea as the theme. But I'm not that boring, obsolete chef anymore. I broke out of my old Szechuan cooking shell, out of Chinese cooking even. This new, cutting-edge version of Terunori Kuga is going to beat you, Eishisukasa. I will never again let you ask, who's Kuga? It's like, wearing a name tag that says, I'm Kuga now.
It's that old Homer Simpson line where he's like drawn all of his name all over our Severn's office. He's like, who the devil are you?
And Tsukasa's like, you really have changed. Yeah. Good for you, buddy. And it's like, oh, it's the council member's dishes. Yeah. And, the female judge takes a bite, from Tsukasa's cooking and immediately it's not only that her clothes are gone. It's that she looks like she's seen the face of God.
Yeah, every piece of clothing is gone except for her crucifix necklace. Okay, where it's just, or I guess cross necklace. There's no Jesus on it. But it's just like, so was this like a life changing experience for her? She's like,
apparently,
I had epiphanies.
Then there's a sometimes the most sexual parts of Shokugeki no Soma don't involve clothes coming off. Sometimes they're when she's like, please, no more. And Tsukasa's like, no, I insist that you must finish all of it. Here, have a bite. Just forces the spoon into her mouth.
Eat it! Eat it!
It would have been so much easier to present this in a different context because it's so weirdly rapey. Because he's just like, I insist, I'll have a problem if you don't eat every bite. She's like, no, I can't take him. Ugh, creepy. So creepy. Time skip happens. You come back and the rest of the chapter is Tsukasa giving his triumphant speech. She's just like, hey, Yukihira, will you be joining us for the next bout or not? Oh, and sorry. I know you worked hard to bring those people together. And we just get a shot of the results board, and all three bouts were won by Central.
Unanimous victories, yeah.
So, there you go!
Look, this was the conclusion I think we kind of all thought would happen, but the point of it is that the last few weeks have been giving us chapters suggesting that might not be the case, and even though the result is exactly as we thought, that doesn't invalidate the fact that we all thought for a moment allowed us to suspend our, you know, fucking smarky manga opinions for a moment and think, who knows what's gonna happen. So, I appreciate that. I imagine we'll probably get some, like, closure next week to how the food from Rindo and Sato actually, like, were received.
Probably. I can't imagine that this is going to go far without, you know, for example, like, the explanation of, like, this is why Saito's was better, despite you having an extra fucking sushi roll there, Yumasaka.
Yeah. So. Yeah, we'll get some sort of context, I imagine. Hopefully actually get to, like, look into how people are reacting to it, too, because it's going to be important to see how these guys respond to losing.
Mm-hmm. It was quite a bit of a wham moment, though, with just... You know, that buildup of like, oh, this is how much Kuga's improved. This is how great Megashima's is. This is, you know, all the stuff that Mimusaka was able to do. And then just that moment where you see, you know, the judge, like, overwhelmed by the experience of taking a bite and you know, well, they're screwed. And then to see the results, it's just like, nope, you stood no fucking chance from the beginning.
So what's interesting is with the way these bouts are going to continue, there's only 5 members left on the Council of 10 who can compete, so we're going to get at least one of these members back for the next round, and they might just, they might just like be like, fuck it, we're just sending the 3 people again, I don't know. I imagine they'll shift up and Aizan will finally force his way into one, but, like, when you look at the remaining people left on the, resistance side, we're going to start actually getting, like, the important characters in now, like, outside of Ishiki taking out somebody, like, it's gonna have to be.
Oh yeah, that's the last guy out of the core 4 that we're training together that there is left.
Yeah.
So we're gonna have to have, you know, at least 2 out of Soma and Megumi and Takumi and Erina. So.
Yeah. So
that it continues the 3-on-3s. I think that they actually established that it doesn't necessarily have to be 3-on-3 each round.
Yeah, I think the notion is just supposed to be they keep going until one side loses all of its members. So I think we might be in for, if they go like Survivor Series rules, we might even get a point where like they just throw in. It wouldn't be shocking if we get a point soon where it's Tsukasa versus like Soma. Mm. And we have to sit there and like, there's other members up and we're like, wait, shit, is this the end or not? Like, cause I think the story could actually go on past Soma losing. Cause you could,
it could come down to Erina, for example.
Yeah, I'd imagine that might be another one. But, since we got a little other series, I won't spend too much time
on it.
Can
you imagine if, like, Takumi's the last man standing and he pulls it out?
He's like,
he got his Dolph Ziggler moment. he's about to get beaten by Tsukasa and then the lights go out. Who's that? Oh my God, it's the man called Sting! He just fucking locks Tsukasa in the scorpion deathlock and prevents him from eating.
You can't make a food if I open your neck. The true ingredient of the Shokugeki was pain. I serve my dish with a healthy extra portion of a tap. One's like, I don't like new Tsukasa. I mean, I love the voice, but I don't know about this direction.
Takumi just does a freaking Mario triple jump.
<Woo-hoo-hoo>! All right, let's do Boruto, I think, right?
That's, Boruto, that's number 15, the supporting shadow. Actually, quite a lot happened in this chapter because I'm kind of surprised that the fight with Gangster Guy is actually not over after Shojoji. After Boruto hit him with his Rasengan, he just gets back up while Boruto is celebrating with Tento. Unfortunately, to come save the day, when Boruto suddenly frees up with paralysis, he tries to form another Rasengan, but oh, the symbol on his palm, it's transforming and expanding. What's going on? And Shojoji, for whatever reason, recognizes the symbol. And he's like, don't tell me you're part of that organization. You gotta love manga in the way they just go, that man, that person. You don't need to use words like that. You can say names. So Boruto and Tento are screwed. But fortunately, help arrives, because Boruto's teammates were just like, we were worried about you after, you know, you said that you weren't going to be able to do the mission, so we kind of ditched it in order to come help you, you dumbass. And, Mitsuki ties up, Shojoji with his stretchy arms. Sarada kicks him in the fucking neck and knocks him out. Sarada shows that she is wearing not very good action gear. Like, come on. Like, your mom wore spats, kid. Like, she understood that if she's gonna be dashing around kicking people, you can't be wearing a fucking skirt. It doesn't matter what length the skirt is. Okay?
It's a ninja,
whether it's short, it's a whether
ninja
it's long.
Skirt, Nick. It's a ninja
it's
skirt.
It's going to be in the way if you kick a lot, okay?
It's ninja skirt. It's the high heels that bother me. It's somewhere. Look, I guess I could just ignore the skirt thing. I guess it's just, I can't. Noelle still wears no pants, Nick. I can't get angry about it every time. But the heels are concerning because, like, your entire fighting style is based on jumping and kicking shit, it seems like. Why would you choose to wear the most obtrusive pair of footwear for doing that? You could literally be wearing roller skates, and I feel like it would be less obtrusive to your actual efforts now.
Oh, boy. Mitsuki also introduces his little snaky buddy. He's got a little animal companion, who he doesn't have a name, so I wonder if it's just, you know, like his, like, I'm Orochimaru's kid, I summon snakes. But, I don't know. I think it would be kind of cool if he had a little bit of a Nakamaru thing with him instead. You know, it's like, I have a little snake companion.
Yeah, I think my favorite part of this chapter is the fact that, like, Sarada and, Mitsuki, show up and kind of help out Boruto, and you're like, oh yeah, like, this is supposed to be a story about the whole team. Like, I kind of forget it because it's only ever about Boruto most of the time, but.
And we go a month between chapters, so if it's just a Boruto story, then we're kind of stuck with him for about half a year.
And that's really what Boruto the series has been. I mean, we've gotten the Scarlet Spring stuff and, you know, the side Mitsuki chapter, but actual, like, team stuff between them, we just had that one moment during, the tuning exams. And then after that, it was fucking Boruto's like, fuck off. I got my own shit to deal with now. Chase
I imagine that the anime is probably playing out a bit differently. By this point, it's got to have easily overtaken the manga.
Yeah.
Because it started months ago and it's running weekly, so. So, Boruto obviously feels a little bit of guilt. His mark, by the way, goes back to being just the little diamond on his palm, as it was before. And they're like, okay, let's get back. Konohamaru scolds them because although they did go to help out their companion, and they did, you know, take down a crime boss and did some good stuff, saving, you know, the daimyo's kid. They did abandon the mission that they were assigned to, and so, like, so you are going to have to be punished for this. You know, you had a responsibility, and you abandoned it. Which is a nice little note. Like, he's being lenient with them, but he's like, you had a duty, and you completely abandoned it. So, you've got to be punished for that. Tento reunites with his dad. He's like, I'm going to be a stronger person and help support you and stuff. I've learned a lot. He's gone through character growth. Good for him. They say their goodbyes for the last time, hopefully, because we just kind of had this moment 2 chapters ago where they say goodbye after trading card and stuff. Anyway, Boruto gives back the card that Tento had given him, the one that he was going to return when he summoned across this whole incident, before. And, Tento says, like, hey, I remember what you said to me before. You know, you must get what you want by your own strength, no matter how hard it is. And, thanks. Shake hands. Bye. They end up going to the card shop, Boruto and his friends, afterward. And so I was like, what are you nerds doing collecting trading cards that aren't Yu-Gi-Oh? She just, like, looks out at the panel. Bye, Yu-Gi-Oh trading cards!
Yeah.
Now with Link summoning! And Nick's like, how does this work?
And Chris is still like, does direct damage deck still work in the game?
Oh, man. And Sarah was also pointing out, like, you know, if you wanted that one card so badly, why, you should have just accepted it. And Bart is like, you don't understand. You're not a man. And Sarah is like, fine, I'll take one of these packs too, you assholes. She goes to the card shop owner and gets money, opens the pack up. And Mitsuki's like, if you get any R or rarer cards, then you're lucky. And so she opens up the pack, and she immediately gets this super awesome special rare Orochimaru card.
I mentioned this on Twitter, and I'm like, I know that the ninja world has apparently, like, ignored or chosen to overlook Orochimaru's, like, heinous war crimes throughout time, and is, like, made peace with them. But it still feels fucked up to make trading cards out of him. Like, he's still not a good person. No matter what redemption he's done, it still seems weird to celebrate him on trading cards. Trading cards, which, by the way, it's not even like it's like a card game. They don't have, it looks like it's just a fucking, like, baseball card, essentially. So it's like, hey, what were the fucking RBI stats for fucking Snake Hitler over there? It's like, I don't know.
12 children kidnapped.
He's like, yo, he had a fucking, like, 9 children per curse ratio back in 08. It was fucking insane. He was playing out of his mind. He had, like, 3 kids that he made kill people. That shit was fucking, you don't see that dedication anymore.
And the big caption that he gets for it, too, is one of the 3 great shinobi Orochimaru. So just, like, just ignore all the other stuff that he did. Assassinating one of the previous Hokage.
I would love if the next card underneath him was the 3rd Hokage, and you're like, well, that was kind of weird. Also, I like that, like, the fucking underlying sexism, too, of Sarada going up to ask for a pack at the gift shop. You'd be like, oh, how unusual. A woman enjoying and purchasing trading cards. Like, what? Is that, like, a thing?
Do you know how fucking many girls would go after Naruto trading cards that had the best looking male ninja in them? What the fuck? Just take her money. Shut up. It's at this moment where Mitsuki, I guess, for the first time brings up, oh yeah, Orochimaru is my parent. Okay.
He's
surprised, like, that they didn't know this detail about him.
Yeah, we just,
well,
know.
You never asked.
We're like, I guess we just maybe assumed, cause, like, the whole, everything about you?
The white skin?
Yeah, the whole snake thing, the whole you don't seem to have, like, a family, or you're just weird. Everything would suggest this, but I guess we just never thought to ask.
Those elongating arms, whatever. There's, like, a last moment focusing on Boruto and Tento's, like, connection and friendship and bond and stuff. And Tento has been in his room thinking to himself, like, I bet you can do it, Boruto. Become an amazing ninja who supports the Hokage. And he puts down another super special rare card, which is the supporting shadow Uchiha Sasuke.
Why the fuck would you ever want a trading card of a character who's not facing the fucking screen? You got a fucking trading card that is a side profile and a face who's 90% hair. I'd be so pissed if I got this. I'd be like, what is this?
It makes him look mysterious, Chris.
Are they using cameras and they just only got one shitty shot? Sasuke had to sign off his rights on this, by the way. Like, he had to, like, there was a discussion for this company to be like, hey, we're releasing this image. So, like, it's not like they had to snap a secret photo. All
right,
somewhere.
Yeah, it says that this is how many royalties you'll make per card sold. And, these will be your stats. This is the information that we'll be sharing about you. Wait, hang on, there's a problem. What is it, Mr. Uchiha? There's not nearly enough of my hair in this shot.
He's
so,
like,
get one for my good side. He, like, turns away from the camera.
Yeah, it's like, well, I mean, no one could see your, yeah, whatever. I got things to do today.
We make sure that there's at least a Sharingan on the shot. Just a little bit. Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
We cut then to where Shujoji is being interrogated by Ibiki and Sai. And there's actually a little note that he makes. Is like, oh, yeah, I've heard about you. Yeah, yeah, you're, you know, Ibiki, and you, I guess you're Yamanaka Sai now. It's like, I guess that does make sense. Sai didn't have a family name because, you know, was just raised by Root. So it makes sense that he would have taken Ino's name when they got married. So Shujoji is like, I've got information that'd be real valuable to you, but I ain't talking unless you give me an inflatable pool. So they bring in Sasuke. Sasuke's like, what do you know about the marking that was on Boruto's arm? Anyway, you're real scary, so I'll tell you. He gives mostly unhelpful information because he's like, yeah, I was there to do a job and I overheard this conversation. That's it. And we cut to, Kara, the Husk, which is the secret society group that he heard a little bit of a conversation about. So he's like, I was really scared, so I pissed my pants and I left.
Bye. He almost literally says that too. He's like, yeah, it was some real bad voodoo. So, yeah, I put myself and promptly left the building. Like, you could have left that one part out. I mean, honestly, you could have left out a lot of this. You really didn't have helpful advice. You could just said Kara the Husk and been done with it.
He says specifically that he knows a lot about Orochimaru's curse marks and that the thing that was on Boruto's hand was different. Not that I give a damn either way. We cut away to a bit of the Husk, who are apparently led by Amon from A Legend of Korra, and they have their, like, soon the land of Konoha will see the light. Ominous conversation. They're like, let's begin. And they're all wearing spooky masks and bits and stuff.
Yeah, so I guess the theme of Husk is they decided to like take Castle Oblivion from Kingdom Hearts and just make it out of squares, because that would be like cooler.
It looks like a Mega Man level, honestly.
Yeah, we're just like, did like you guys decide on cubes for everything, or did you just find a place that was only cubes, or is this the cube world that you could all transport yourselves to? Why would you do this? Are you a cube gimmick? This seems really weird. There's just cubes sticking out of walls. You don't have things over there. Are you meant to go over there? There's one chair. There's six of you. There's one chair. Nothing else.
It's a real, like, Men in Black room chair, too. It's this weird, futuristic oval shape.
Like, it'd be like the one dude's like, can I, you know, my feet are kind of tired. Can I get a chair? He's like, oh.
Solomon Grundy wants a chair, too.
He's like, oh, I'd love to give you a chair, but there's clearly no space for it. Like, what about our distant cube over there? It'd have nothing on it. No, that's where my Vitrola will go. That shut him up.
That's where the commode's going to be. Can Solomon Grundy sit on toilet when not being used?
Solomon,
don't be gross.
that's disgusting. You could be a Neanderthal, but don't be gross.
Born on a Monday. Yes, we get it.
I've heard your whole speech. Solomon Grundy, go on. Like, no, I'm not giving you your
fucking... I don't believe in that stuff, Grundy. Bird face be there too? Yes, you'll be there. Yes.
Hey, does that exact same fucking like, oh, just like, no, I don't care. There's no God. you rot the ground in nothingness. Fuck you.
Now Grundy gets his reward. No, you failed. You died. You're getting nothing.
Yeah. Even if there was a God, this one act doesn't like counteract all the horrible acts you'd have done. So even if your God did exist, which he doesn't, he would still hate you. Anyway,
all
goodbye.
The DCAU references.
I like this chapter, though. I like the end of it particularly because I like the idea of, like, moving into a new arc, villain group. Like, let's start setting up the identity of Boruto by having him up against a new foe.
And yes, we'll give him his own Akatsuki. Great idea. Let's be different.
I mean, fuck. It couldn't be worse than how the actual Akatsuki played out.
Both of them went down like chumps, yes. Okay. Alright, let's move on to Dr. Stone then. I think it's over this way.
Time to get stoned!
You're gonna say that every week.
Every week now. It's a catchphrase, Nick.
So, last time, in order to win over the people of the village and make them his servants to help him make iron, Senku decided to make some apparently very bad tasting ramen. Z equals 23, the smooth talker is where we pick up. Cool cover page of Senku chilling out on some sort of weird contraption that has been grown over. They bring in the ramen. Meanwhile, the high council of the village or something like that are like, what should we do about all of this? And one of the guys is like, hey, chief, can we go, you know, eat it? No. No. No.
No.
And Senku is like, behold my science gourmet! Yes, yes, that's very nice. People eat it. They love it. The girl who wanted a man to provide for her is like, hey, what's your type of girls that you prefer?
I love that answer. Senku's like, girls who can pump tons of oxygen into an iron forge? That's fucking great!
So incredibly specific and blatant.
She's like, I like a guy who can be dependable. What do you like? I like girls who can pump a lot of oxygen into an iron forge, like that one right over there. Perhaps we should go see.
Yeah, let me show me how you... Yeah, girl. Show me how you pump tons of oxygen into the iron forge.
Show me how you take me into the Iron Age. Yeah, you girl, dirty, dirty girl.
Girl, turn around.
You're gonna
and
be dirty because you're
funny. Girl, turn around and let me see how you pump oxygen into the iron forge. Yeah, girl. You know what really gets my blood going? What really gets me going? Makes me want to really make babies. Yeah, seeing a girl pump tons of oxygen into an iron forge.
She's like, oh, Senku, talk dirty to me. He's like, I kind of feel like we should just run away right now and start pumping oxygen into an iron forge. Yeah. I don't care what people think.
That's what really gets me going. So, they're serving up ramen, winning people over. What's it? Kojiro, I think is his name. The really stuck-up spear guy. Is still like, no! We can't accept food from people. And Kohaku's like, well, you still got your golden spear, so, like, is it okay if you have treasure but not food? Like, yeah. While this is going on, you know, Senku is overhearing the chatter that people are having. You know, it's like, oh, noodles get mushy while you guys are arguing. It makes a man thirsty. What I wouldn't give for a cola right now. Cola brand cola. It's not Coke or Pepsi.
Buy Yu-Gi-Oh! And have a nice cola with it. I'm like, I feel like this week's jump's really advertising to me.
Buy Yu-Gi-Oh! Cola.
Every drink comes with a rare card. It's been dissolved into Coke, so you won't actually get to use it. But there was one when we put it into the plant.
It will poison you, probably. That's cardboard and foil.
The holographic foil is absolutely toxic to ingest. It's actually bad luck to get a super rare.
Yu-Gi-Oh! Cola, good enough to die for, which you will because you just drank it.
Also, it's shaped like a dragon.
Kai was like, sign me up! Give me all of the cans in the world!
I love this drink.
Becomes their spokesperson. Yu-Gi-Oh! Cola. I don't mind the taste.
I have money enough to cure the poisoning I get.
Turns green, immediately has to inject his neck with the end.
Uh-oh.
It's worth it. Tastes like dragon. Kinro and Ginro were their names. There we go. So, Senku's like, did you fucking say cola? Huh. A friend of yours? No. Senku's like, no, he's not pumping oxygen into an iron ore for me, so of course he is.
It's the only thing I want.
So, Kohaku breaks up Ginro and Kinro from squabbling because she's like, we've got an enemy here. And immediately all three of them spring into action and surround the stranger with their weapons. And so they're like, hey, if you don't want to die, you better explain yourself right away. And the guy's like, my hair is fucking weird. Look at his hair. I don't know exactly. It's not that it looks weird. It's that I literally don't know where the dye begins and ends. Like,
it has to be natural. You'd think at this point in the world, hair dye would not be the most important thing. So it must be like maybe that's how the stove broke off. I don't know, Nick. Jotaro's hat just disappears into his hair. So I sometimes I stop asking these questions.
You know, you might think like, oh, maybe it's growing out. And so the hair, the part that was dyed, has been grown out because he's been unfrozen from the stone for a while. But no, because some of the tips of his hair are black, which is where the base is. Blah. Anyway, his hair looks strange, and it throws me off. Something fierce. Senku says, I know who you are. I recognize your face. You're Gen Asagiri. You're a bullshit mentalist.
Well, actually, there, we could actually see that it must be something, because his hair in the picture is all black. So maybe the white is something that caused it.
Maybe something in the stone petrification caused the discoloration. Who knows? Senku knows him because he's been written up, he's some magician who wrote a trashy book on psychology. Just the complete, I am a man of science, I know you are bullshit, approach from Senku. Hi, I'm Senku, man of silence, you're Gen Asagiri, and you're full of shit. Nice to meet you. He's like, I prefer that you call me a mentalist. Doesn't matter, it's all bullshit. Fuck you. So Senku's like, hey, you know, there's no such thing as free lunch in this world, you know. There's plenty of work to be done by everyone who has enjoyed this ramen. You are all indebted to me, bitches. And, you know, gluttony guy is like, you mean like washing dishes? And of course, we get an immediate smash cut to them. Pumping oxygen into an iron ore while Senku is off in the corner masturbating.
Yeah, he's like, oh, this is so hot.
It's perfect,
oh
yes.
Oh my god.
So many of them.
Everyone's pumping oxygen into my iron too!
While he's got him in this situation, Senku approaches Gen and he's like, hey, how are Taiju and Yuzuriha doing these days? And Gen immediately collects himself. He's like, ah, you think that you'll be able to pull it over on me while I'm distracted and slaving away? You're such a brave man to challenge a mentalist to that sort of battle. But don't worry, they're doing just fine. Especially Taiji with his butterless stamina. But you know all about that, Senku. So this really threw me off when I read this chapter. Because I'm like, I'm kind of taken for granted, I guess, Senku's ability to perfectly keep track of time. Because I don't really know how much time has passed since he broke off from Yuzuriha and Taiju. Because this seems to imply that they've been away from each other for, like, weeks. If Gen is part of Tsukasa's group, knows what's going on with Taiju and Yuzuriha, and has gone off to scout for him. That seems to imply a lot of time has passed.
It may not be a tremendous amount, because remember all the people that Senku has been able to meet in this short of a time. You know, you could assume that Tsukasa's group would maybe meet people that quickly as well, especially when that's like kind of express purpose is to find more people. But, it is tough to tell exactly how much time has passed. I assume at least like a few days to a week, but I'm not sure. No, we definitely see more because they've been talking about how like weeks have passed with, like science experiments and stuff they've been doing. Like it took a while for like, I think like some of the different aspects of the shit they've been building over the past few weeks to actually finish. Like some of the potions and shit. I think.
I don't recall specifically. I guess it would definitely take a lot of time to fucking thresh wheat in order to make ramen, so.
Yeah.
So, Gen says, you know, like, yeah, I was kind of going to work for Tsukasa, but now that I see what you're working on here, I think I might be kind of, you know, changing my mind. Because, sure enough, Senku starts to forge some metal, after pouring the, you know, melted down iron into, whatever you call it. Then the word escapes me.
Cast, essentially.
Yes, pot. Essentially. Pot. Gen says, yes, my job was to confirm that you were definitely completely dead. And if I went back and said, hey, Tsukasa, Senku's still alive, well, he would come out here and kill you. That was my plan originally. But now that I see that you're working on iron weapons, who can say how the tides of war may shift? So I'll feed him some lies as a favor to you. I'll be saving you. And he says, I don't hold any hard and fast policies. I'm just the world's smoothest talker. Living a life of ease with a horde of cute girls is all I want. Doesn't matter to me whether it's you or Tsukasa. who ends up dead. Senki's like, this horde of girls you talk about, how much oxygen would they pump to the Iron Forge?
That his soul base is going forward even after he's passed the Iron Age.
He's moved past perfecting ironworking. He still is like, that's just my fetish. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, he's like, I fucking love chicks and dudes, anyone, really, even machines that are just able to pump oxygen into Iron Forges. It
you know how many times I was arrested at the local ironworking facility because I just went in there and just stared at stuff while drooling?
Not actually often. Apparently the people there don't have high standards on things. They're pretty okay with it. They don't get a lot of business.
Really poor security measures. Apparently no one really goes into there to do anything.
I also, a question, maybe this is Gen's logic of the Iron Age, because of course they have all the people that with like their weapons and armor. Kohaku's got the classic female armor of something around the breast, that's it. But Senku has a shotgun.
Yeah. I'm like, that's how iron forges work.
I'm like, I mean, I guess they did kind of discover gunpowder, but I feel like there's more parts that need to happen before we can get to like live ammunition and working firearms.
I mean, looking at them, Chrome has a spear. Ginro has a fucking buster blade.
Well, I think he's supposed to be Guts. I assume that
he's basically Guts.
Yeah.
Not quite the same armor, but yes, basically. And Kohaku is, you know, going for a barbarian look with a freaking claymore. And then, yeah, there's Senku there in, you know, plate mail armor. Cool. And yeah, he's got a fucking gun. He's just different centuries entirely. Oh, man. You're going to need to do a lot of refining in order to do that. But anyway, Gin's point is that, hey, you know, I thought that Tsukasa was definitely going to win this, but now that I see her working on iron weapons, you know, I think I'll just, you know, play my cards right from here. I'll leave my options open. I always bet on the winning horse, no matter whom I have to cut loose. So, you know, I could betray Tsukasa and join you. It's the Tsukasa Empire versus your Kingdom of Science. I wonder which will triumph in the end. And Senku's like, well, it's obvious the Kingdom of Science will triumph, and we get, you know, the shot of, like, iron obtained while Chrome and company are celebrating over it. It was kind of confusing with the timetable, but this is an interesting element that's been thrown in here, with this double agent type of character that is very upfront about, like, no, I'm not very trustworthy, but, you know, I'll work for myself, and he could very easily throw a monkey wrench into things for either side going forward.
Yeah, like, he's a character I could see being fun if he stuck around, just because he's, like, a smooth talker, but clearly also, like, a fraud, so it'd be easy just to turn him down, but he does introduce an intriguing element here of, like, what happens if, like, both sides just get to know what the other is doing now? Like, if there's no shock to Tsukasa, then he's like, oh, well, Senku and his Kingdom of Science are going to come at me with steel or iron and metal weapons and armor and things like that. Like, presumably this level of stuff goes both ways, so it'll be interesting. I like the tactic a lot.
I think that with Gin, we're going to have to see more from him going forward. He leaves the immediate impression of, like, more potential than, like, an immediate, oh, wow, this character is really over the top, as a lot of the recent cast have been. Mm-hmm. So let's move on to We Never Learn and Boobs.
Yes, so We Never Learn, question 27, a genius is frightened of the horrible X while he ponders over it. And the cover page is our leading ladies in their swimsuits. Hose is being sprayed on Ogata, and she's not happy about that, but I guess she's powerless to stop it because, I don't know, she's maybe comfortable in a little inner tube. I don't know. And of course there is then a panel page following that just explains, like, all the characters reacting to it, and they're like, man, that was, like, kind of embarrassing and shit.
Why did we do that? Who are we posing for?
I mean, we can see Uega, I guess, is maybe also in a swimsuit, but he wasn't even included on the front page. He's just at the very end in, like, a corner shot.
He was like, I wanted to have an inner tube.
It's like, I want to swim. So the chapter.
And then we get a joke about how Femino's flat chested, so she, yeah.
Yeah. It was very, enlightening. The actual chapter itself involves Kirisu Sensei, who is waiting for Uega to come by, grabs him, and basically, like, drags him back to her apartment, which he cleaned previously and is now already back to being an utter pigsty. But the reason she actually brought him here.
She's actually waiting outside of her apartment as Yuika Box walks by.
Yeah.
So.
So she grabs him because, not because the apartment's messy per se, but because there is a bug in there and she doesn't like bugs. She's terrified of them. She needs someone to help her. So, the bug gets away. They're like, all right, we'll have to clean up to actually do this. And Yuika cleans everything up. There's a couple moments of like a little bit of like, oh, hey, my teacher's like got this side of her that's like very like human and really desperate for this for some reason. And also a shot where she's bent over.
She apparently shops at the same clothing department as Iruka.
Yeah, we saw this last time too, where she had like pants that are so tight we can see the outline of her underwear and it's going up her ass. These are pants that I think are like vacuum sealed from the inside, but they didn't turn that all. Like it's still happening. Like it's still vacuum sealing or something. I don't know. It's dangerous.
Just a constant sound following her.
Maybe in this world, all of the female characters' anuses are actually vacuums that are sucking things in, like a black hole. And that explains why they're constantly suffering from wedgies, because I don't know any other way to explain it. But yeah, she was like, hey, stay here, just as long as, somebody else here. I don't want to be alone with the insect. So she's like, I'll help you study so you're not here wasting your time. And I ordered takeout for us too. And of course.
No, she actually, it's kind of funny because she specifically says, I'll do anything. Don't leave me here alone. And Yuika's like, she'll do anything. Yuika's like, help me study.
And yeah, they order takeout for dinner, and of course the person who shows up is Ogata, because she works at a restaurant, and she has the udon. So she sees, Yuika at Kirisu Sensei's place, and is not happy about it. So she decides to stay and then eat with them, and, Kirisu Sensei changed clothes, I guess, because she wants to look proper around Ogata, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some tension there, because, Yuika's basically getting death glares from Ogata, who's just like, why the fuck are you here? And then she's getting death glares from Kirisu Sensei, who's just like, don't you fucking tell her! I need to remain respectful, goddammit! And, she's like, oh, this is, like, kind of awkward, but, there's a moment they decide to play a board game, but it's definitely something that is, like, Japanese-based that doesn't translate, because I have
Bat. That's not a bat.
I had no fucking clue what's happening, but yeah, sure, I guess she lost a lot. I guess Ogata's not good at board games. But it doesn't help, because tensions are still the high right now. Kirisu Sensei goes to make some coffee, and Ogata's like, Yuika's like, oh, okay, this is a chance to kind of explain the situation. Yuika's not good at explaining things, I guess, because he chooses to, like, take the most roundabout way to getting to his point. He was trying to, I believe, explain how Kirisu actually sees her students and why she's been so kind of harsh on, like, wanting them to abandon this idea of, like, going for their weakest subjects and everything like that.
It's her way of showing that she cares.
Yes. But he starts it off by saying, you know, sometimes someone really cares about you and it can be hard to see. And maybe it hasn't always seemed that way, but some people have difficulty showing how they really feel. And if possible, you could open up your heart. And it's like, just fucking, why would you lead it in all that way? It's such a convoluted way of saying it. Just be like, sometimes, you know, people do what seems like it's mean, but they're doing it for our best interest. I don't know.
Sometimes, Ogata, people that are near you really want to kiss you and date you and hold you. But you just need to be willing to look out for it and open yourself up to that idea that you could be held and kissed by them. By a guy like me, we could be making out here in this room. So anyway, Kirisu Sensei.
Yeah, it's just like the worst way to start this. But yeah, he's like trying to explain it. And I guess the notion is, now, because he's brought in Kirisu Sensei, it fully, like, miscommunicates it to Ogata, because she's like, he says, there's an awkwardness sometimes, and it can lead to misunderstandings, but there's real love in caring about your student's success. And Ogata just gives him this look like she's like about to jump in from Ibitsu or something. She's like, could you clarify the subject and use the active voice? But I do like how he's like, oh, this is terrifying. But hey, you corrected my grammar. You've come a really long way. Good job, Ogata. I guess, though, Ogata does get the impression, though, because she does start thinking back to that actual scenario. Then Karasu-sensei pops back in because she's scared the bug's back!
Return of the bug!
And Ogata's kind of annoyed because Karasu-sensei's kind of wrapped all around Yuiga while this is happening.
Also, her skirt is in danger of following after her sweatpants.
How does a skirt do that? I mean, like...
I don't know!
Like, I don't...
It is at once clinging around her body, but also it manages to drop between her butt cheeks as like, well.
You'd think if it were clinging...
Do both.
Yeah. You'd think if you were clinging to her like that, it would at least raise the back of the skirt up, too. She's like, oh, no, yeah. I always buy skirts with extra back length, you know, because of my vacuumous anus.
I always buy contoured skirts.
If you can hear me, carry
technical, on. You're good, yeah. Technical difficulties, everybody. We'll get back into this. All right, so yeah, the bug has returned. There's this misunderstanding going on, and Ogata is obviously pissed off because she's like, "Oh yeah, teacher's love is, you know, for a student's success." Is like, and Yuiga's like, "I'm pretty sure you're not getting the right idea from what's going on here." And then it's like they try and build it up like it's some sort of horror movie and the bug is, you know, an axe-wielding murderer who suddenly is going after Ogata because they're like, Ogata! It's coming for you! Run! Very poorly defined kind of cockroach thing. It's like, it's not going to eat her. And then she kills it.
Yeah.
Roll the paper. They're like, oh, right. She was raised in a restaurant, so she would be used to this kind of thing. What a tough girl. It's just a bug.
Yeah.
Kill them.
They make a big deal out of it. But
I know that some people in general have a really hard time dealing with insects, and it is frequently true that women can have a hard time dealing with them. I'm not saying like, oh yeah, you know, men folk have to come and kill the bugs and stuff. It's like, some people don't react well to them. But the fact that they are expressing such shock that she could kill is like, yeah, okay. When has Ogata ever been shown to be a timid person? Ever. Except when it comes to her feeling for you again, but that's beside the point.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay.
You're coming through just fine.
Alright, so yeah, essentially that's the end of it. They have a small moment there where, Kirisu's basically still kind of grilling Ogata on, like, hey, you may be getting better at your English grammar, like, work, but there's a lot you still need to get ready. You need to, you know, you're not actually, do you think you can pass a literary test like that if you don't know about abstract text? And, you know, they're gonna still work on that. But as they're walking away, Ogata's just like, huh, I didn't, you know, ever think that she would be someone who had like a weakness, like especially for something like a bug. I guess I was really wasn't paying attention. And it's like, oh, well, you know, I guess we really don't pay enough attention to the people around us. Ha ha, we've all learned something together. Thanks, Yuiga, you showed me that. And that's essentially the chapter.
And there's a little closing joke that's kind of cute, which is, you know, Gata says, hey, Yuiga, if there's a bug at my house, would you come to my rescue too? And Yuiga's like, what would be the point of that? She gets upset. It's like, but he makes a really good point. It's like, you can handle bugs yourself. You just demonstrated that.
That's not the point. This is a classic fucking relationship thing. That's not the point.
And he's like, did I say the wrong thing again?
Yeah, you always say the wrong thing, Yuiga. I wasn't a fan of this chapter very much, though.
No.
The joke of, like, being afraid of a bug in a house is just such, like, a stupid hacky joke that doesn't, they don't do anything new with it. There's no like new humor to explore in that really. So the comedic premise of this chapter isn't really there. And, I don't know. I just didn't really feel like this was a particularly strong chapter for either like Ogata or Kirisu. Like we kind of just.
It was an incredible contrivance to get the two of them together, honestly, too.
And also, it just didn't feel like we found out that much. The big thing to find out from this is that, oh, I guess Ogata realizes Kirisu, like, in her strictness, is trying to look out for her. Which would be fine, but, I mean, like, Fumiko needs to learn that, too. Like, it feels like that would have been a chapter that all the girls should have had a moment with Kirisu and made that more of the emphasis of the chapter rather than, like, hidden beneath the joke of, oh, are you fucking the teacher?
It was weird because it was, like, it was seeming to go in the direction that it would be a Kirisu chapter, and then it turned out to be an Ogata chapter in terms of she's the one who actually learns the lesson. I think that it needed to be a little bit more even between them in terms of what they ended up getting out of the conversation, because it seems as though Ogata was really the only one who seemed to learn anything from it, when it seems like it's something that they should have both ended up benefiting from.
Yeah.
Unless you count the fact that Ogata killed the bug for Kirisu.
I like the notion of this chapter. I just think its execution wasn't particularly strong.
Okay, with that one in the books, we're going to move on to The Promised Neverland. Big color pages. Cool. So the kids have completely gone on their own, leaving behind Sunju and Mushika. And so they get to see this wide open area out waiting for them. Is just a very big landscape shot that we get really to start things off with birds flying over, and there's a plateau in the on the horizon and stuff. They're like, "Wow, look at all this space going on here." Yeah, so we're gonna head out this way, and we're gonna go on our destination. They exchange final goodbyes with Sunju and Mujika, and Sunju says, as long as you walk in this wasteland, you won't run into any demons. If all goes well, you should be able to see your Mr. Minerva tonight. Ooh. He says to them, hey, yeah, you know, be careful and good luck. Mujika also shares some special goodbye with Emma, and she secretly hands her an amulet, and she says, make sure you hold on to this. I'm sure it will protect you. Search for the seven walls. The future you all seek is beyond that. Ooh. After they depart, Sanju, you know, starts talking with Mujika, and he says, you know, you've gotten pretty attached to them. You know, you didn't seem to be that interested all that much at first. And we get a flashback to way back before the two of them encountered the kids. And, so they were secretly discussing what to do before they intervened, and Mujika's like, yeah, they're humans, the escapees mentioned in the notification. If we turn them into the farm, we would be able to live comfortably for at least 6 months. And at that moment, Sanju said, I'm not going to turn them into the farm. I'm going to save them. And so now they bring this up back up in the present. They're like, so what are you planning here? What's going on? You know, at the time you said that you were doing this because you were just curious, but that's a lie. Why did you decide that you were going to save these children? And Sunju says, only humans can break the promise, and that promise is troublesome. It destroyed our faith, society, and our species' appearance. Perhaps they can destroy it. And maybe when that happens, we can finally hunt humans again. I can't wait for the day when I can eat as many humans as I want. So it turns out that there was a dark twist to one of these characters. Although, bizarrely enough, despite that, it turns out that his goals and the kid's goals just line up.
Yeah, it's sort of it's a weird... I'm sure there is a level of this sort of veganism in the real world, but it's like, I'm not against eating humans. I just don't want that farm-raised shit. I like to hunt wild animals or something. And mm-hmm. It's sort of a weird explanation for that, but it works enough, I guess.
Also, he raised the suspicion of, like, hey, so what are you doing with Emma over there? And Mujika's like, nothing, just a goodbye. All right, I'm going to go get rid of the nuisance. And Mujika is thinking to herself as he departs, like, you know, Emma understands what's going on here. The future they're heading toward is different from what Sanju wishes for. Work hard and win that future. You can do it. That's right. There's more than one promise. The promise is... So, pretty big revelations at the start of the chapter, about Sanju, about the promise, there being apparently another promise besides the one that Sanju told Emma and Rei about. Yeah.
A nuisance, seven walls, the pendant.
I wonder if the nuisance that he's talking about is just the hunters that are after the kids, honestly.
possibly, I don't know.
It seems to be basically hints of what the kids are going to have to do in order to get to the human world, basically. The kids, continue on their way, and eventually they're like, hey, so are we close? What are our coordinates right now? And so, you know, Emma takes out the pen, and they're like, we've reached B0632. We're right here. We're exactly where we're supposed to be. But there's nothing here. Dun, dun, dun. And, that's it. They're in the middle of this plane, and there is nothing there, and, what are they gonna do? So.
It might be a city in the sky. Decent chapter.
It could be. You've just got to believe, and, you know, it was there. It was there, wasn't it?
You just have to get to the knockout screen. Alright, let's, we've
got, could be underground.
We got a very limited amount of time to get through three chapters. So, chapter 230 of Seven Deadly Sins, The Chosen Soldiers, this one's basically pretty straightforward. Melodius has kind of like lost control because he chose to unleash all of his demon power while his emotions have been taken from him in the whole Bella Schoola trap. So a couple of the sins are kind of working to keep him confined right now. Merlin's trapped him in a box and Escobar's in there with him. And I don't care if his name's not Escobar, it's always going to be Escobar to me. while the rest of them take on Bella Schoola, and there's just some kind of like crazy attacks that go on back and forth. Primarily, the danger is, Diana kind of like lures her in with some earth magic to just whoop her ass. The king gets a big hit, but she puts in like, hey, you can't kill me, because if you do, then your fucking fairy girl dies. And then Elizabeth's just like, nah, we're just going to like de-age you into a snake. Essentially, like, take away your power to its base core.
The sneaky snake.
Yeah, you're a little cute little snake now. And you can't die.
And now Mitsuki will adopt you, and you'll be his animal companion.
Yeah. Or make trading cards out of your mean-ass dad. So, yeah, they basically put the snake in a bottle, trap her, and boom. Now we don't have to worry about, the one girl dying, whose name I've forgotten in this moment. But who cares? Yeah, that one. And
RuPaul.
Chapter ends with Escobar squaring off against, like, evil Melodius. That's the chapter.
Yeah. Also, there was a pretty disturbing shot of Melaskula's poison melting away Bond's body. Yeah. So, pretty intense for a really quick action chapter and stuff. Black Clover! It's the continuation of the final first-round match in the team competition. And we get a flashback from the perspective of Alec Dora, the Golden Dawn guy who is jealous of Yuno. Apparently he was seemingly abandoned on a battlefield following an ambush and thought he was going to die because no one would bother to come back for him. But William Vengeance did come back for him, discovered him, and rescued him. And so after that, you know, he was like, I completely devoted my Grimoire to its service after that. I worked hard to ensure that the Golden Dawn would continue to be the strongest brigade. We are an elite team of nobles chosen by Master Vengeance. However, in our midst, why is that peasant here? Not only that, but Master Vengeance always interacted with all his brigade members equally, and yet, with this boy, with him, he called his name 5 times today, even though he hasn't spoken to me once. He's a little bit crazy, basically, is the point. A little bit overreactive to the attention that Vengeance is giving Yuno. He's like, oh, and he's mocking Master Vengeance and saying he's going to be the next master of the Golden Dawn. How dare he? Don't get so full of yourself. Belle, little sylph, is just like, hey, get him! Let's get him, you know? And he was like, I'll handle this myself. And we also get some interaction between Noelle. The other guy on the opposing team gets affected by a fucking giant mushroom on his shoulder, as their teammate apparently specializes in fungus magic, which includes him traveling around on the weird cartoonish running mushroom.
This has been the most unique interpretation of fungus magic I've seen. None of these feel like fungal things as much as it is other spells that are just shaped like mushrooms, but hey, more power to you.
He communicates with Noelle through a weirdly mannish faced mushroom on her shoulder. She makes weird faces through the whole chapter. We get a little bit of a badass moment from the guy. He's like, you know, I heard Solid's remarks before the match. No big brother worthy of the name would say such things. I have 10 younger brothers and sisters, you see. I'm fighting for them. Big brothers exist to protect the younger, weaker siblings who are born after them. And you speak only words that will wound yours. Get him, Noelle! Trash your brother! It's like, this guy's pretty awesome. I like Ichigo, weakling sorcerer. Noelle is being attacked by Solid, by his watery snake guys. And he's still continuing to insult her as he does so, saying, ah, you're weak. There's no way a failure like you could beat me. And Noelle says, you know, that's right. I was weak. And you've always been strong, Solid. You probably can't understand how weak people feel. At this point, I don't care whether you acknowledge me or not. She flashes back to all the people that she's encountered through the series who have acknowledged her abilities and her potential, like Fuego Leon and Yami and Asta. And she says, I've been acknowledged by much greater people. Long ago, I was really afraid of your magic, Solid. Now it feels really flimsy. And she summons her fucking sea dragon. We also cut over briefly to, you know, defeating I've already forgotten his name, with a giant freaking tornado, which he summons inside of his golem in order to destroy it from the inside. And the guy's like, how did he do that? How is that possible? And Yuno's like, I don't know anything about other people's dreams. The only dreams I see are my own. Good for you. Noelle summons her sea dragon thing, casts sea dragon's roar. It completely freaking obliterates Solid and the crystal in one shot. Good for you, Noelle.
Yeah.
And she concludes it all by saying, I'm not weak anymore. Real awesome chapter for Noelle. Pretty much everything she says through this chapter was right on point. Cool moment for all three members of her team. Really like this chapter.
Yeah, it was solid. I like this one a lot. It was
solid.
It's nice to get that moment.
I do wish that we had a little bit more time because I would kind of like to dwell on this, but we've got to move on to One Piece to wrap up. Okay. One Piece chapter 875. Where were we? A woman's honor. So, lots of stuff happens, as happens in every One Piece chapter, it seems like. We cut around to the various different people a bunch of different times, but I'll try and just hit the very important stuff. Big Mom is still on her rampage. What ends up happening is that they're still luring Zeus around with the thunderclouds that Nami is summoning from her climatact. While they're all trying to beat it on foot to get away because, the tree's been, you know, nearly killed. Big Mom tries to call Zeus back to her. Prometheus is really pissed off because he's not obeying her commands, because he's just still obsessed with all the storm clouds that Nami is feeding him and still pursuing after them. Luffy tries to beat Prometheus back with some of his armament haki, but it doesn't work, which is a big revelation because, like, it's even more, it goes even beyond the immunities of Logia type. So instead, Jinbei's just like, here, I'm going to use some water power. Goes over to the bridge, casts it towards Prometheus. It really hurts him. And they're like, it worked. It's like, well, yeah, he's flame, so. There you go. He says specifically, think of him like a great big talking house fire. How very specific.
Yeah, I get it. That makes sense.
We get a bit of Pedro engaging in some of the other pursuers. One of them wears a creepy mask. Someone snatches Carrots and tries to drag her away. Luffy has to look after Carrot. He snags her. I made that same mistake the first time I read this chapter, mistaking what was happening in that panel. They're like, okay, look, we've got to all stick together and keep running and moving, because if we get separated, then we're freaking screwed. Meanwhile, Zeus catches Nami by surprise, because all of a sudden he comes down and snags the weather egg that she had summoned at the end of her climb attack to effectively lure him away. And all of a sudden he just grows massively and it just has a huge reaction to it. This huge thundercloud that takes up the entire sky. And, so Mom and her soldiers are almost upon them. So she's like, hey, you know, my mother egg that I summoned and all those clouds that were inside of him are still inside of Zeus. So she casts her tempo. Well, shit. I never really thought that Nami would end up having the biggest attack of the entire Straw Hat crew, but it just happens.
Yeah, that's a pretty baller-ass attack.
This huge fucking explosion goes off, stuns Mom and the rest of them, and we get over to the port where a bunch of her soldiers are still waiting. They're like, I guess that Mama used Zeus to finish them off. Well, that takes care of that. We're all done here. Except for Katakuri, who's just like, nope. Chopper and Brook react to this because they arrive on shore too, and they're like, hey, you know, we'll give you one chance here. You can get inside that submarine and you can use that to escape yourselves and leave this behind. This is your only chance that we're going to give you. And of course, Brook and Chopper are both like, no, that's our Sunny. It's a cool little bit. And finally, to close out the chapter, we cut to, I almost called her Lola. That's not her name. Chiffon. And Pudding. And, Chiffon's like, okay, yeah, we're gonna do this. And she has a brief little flashback to when she's, you know, tried to have a cool moment with Beige and say like, hey, you know, it's easy to say thank you for saving Lola, but the real test of character comes when that savior is in trouble. That's what it means to uphold my honor. And if anything should happen to me, you'll have to raise Pez on your own. I'm sure that won't come up, though. She'll be fine. They're flying overhead and they're like, oh, right up there. There they are. It's Sanji. And Pudding's like, yes, it's that darn Sanji. Pudding lies to everybody. Doop-a-doop-a-doop. I've given up on trying to guess what the hell she's up to, because it just lies to everyone. Forget it.
She's good. When she thinks about Sanji, she gets angry.
She just gets angry. It could very well turn out that that's what happens. Like, I'm not going to believe anything.
I legitimately think that. It's just like a Sundare kind of thing. Like, she's just like, oh, I don't like that Sanji. But I actually really love him because he touched
me. I'm not going to believe
anything. But I hate that Sanji. That's
what happens. Forget it.
Nick, look, I'm a puddingologist, so at this point...
Wombology? The study of Wombo?
Exactly. I did not work for 20 plus years to earn my puddingology degree to not be referred to by a doctor title.
Dr. Rollo T. Dr. Rollo T, MD.
Well, it's
Dr. Rollo T, PD.
I earned it a bit ago, so it's actually Dr. Lord Von Quack. It's an old school one. But, I try to make it Dr. LBQ. You know, so it's a little bit more hip with the kids.
All right. That's going to have to do it. Let's wrap up by naming our favorites for this week. Favorite series and MVP.
Chapter's a hard one.
Chapter is tough.
I think, I guess I'll say, I'll go with Black Clover. Just in terms of like the one that's like through and through, I think probably the more enjoyable one. Although I don't. Yeah, I'll just go with Black Clover.
I'm gonna go with Black Clover as well. Same reason, like I said, it just had a great moment for all three members of the team. Really awesome moments and a great way for Noelle to finally get the chance to stand up for herself and take down one of her asshole siblings. And as much as a couple of different characters definitely had their moments to shine, like with Nami doing the Thundercloud, but I went with Noelle because it's a much more important chapter for her as a character moment and her big coming out party.
Yeah, I mentioned last time that Noelle didn't get MVP primarily because she hadn't actually, like, that moment was still coming where she'd prove herself better. So I'll give it to Noelle here because that moment came in. It's pretty sweet. But Nami was another strong alternative.
Hmm.
As well as, honestly, Sarada, I liked a lot this recent chapter as well.
Like she got to kick some ass, and she had that moment where she was like, fuck your sexism! Women can buy trading cards, too!
She's like, I have now learned that this is a waste of money! Just like a man! These just are like worthless! You can't even battle
longer
these!
And far more packs to realize.
I have to really resist the urge. Whenever I see someone opening Hearthstone packs, just be like, maybe I should open some Hearthstone packs.
All right. That is going to do it for Weekly Manga Recap, guys. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. We record the show normally on smashcast.tv/reloadt and twitch.tv/reloadt. Wednesday is around 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, though sometimes we need to change things up to stay updated on when we're going to start recording the show. Follow us on Twitter. Your hosts are at RoloT and at YRuler of Time, and the official podcast account is at WMR Podcast, where you can usually get brief previews of what Chris's thoughts are as he's preparing for the podcast. You can also check out past episodes of the show on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com, as well as on iTunes and our YouTube account. Be sure to give us a subscription, comment, rating, all that good stuff, so that you can help us beat the woodworkers in the hobby section and become king of the podcasts.
Did we do the chat MVP or series of the week?
No. Let me go take a look at that real quick. I don't think I've actually done that in a while. The winner of the poll is One Piece this week, although coming up close behind were Dr. Stone and Black Clover. So both, all three pretty strong. No love for Food Wars or Boruto, but there you go. Or something that sense for that matter. Whatever. Anywho. So, that is that. The subscription is coming to... Special thanks to our Patreon supporters. You can support the podcast, patreon.com/weeklymangarecap. We have different reward tiers. If you want to get the bonus episode each month, then be sure to become a champion-level subscriber. You can get that kind of good stuff.
Yeah,
your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy, which we really like to do, including not just that bonus episode, but also monthly commentaries on stuff.
Yes. I know we had some new patrons. Unfortunately, I can't name them off because for whatever reason, Patreon site is not loading up names for me right now. So anybody who did put in the support, I'll get to you the next week. Hopefully, it'll be fixed up. I don't want you to feel like we're ignoring you or anything like that.
That's cool. Special thanks to go out to Steve Manor of Tile Cards. You can check out his work in a number of different places. He also got his own Patreon. He did the tile card that, if you're watching the video, you'll be seeing of that creepy false smile. He's got significantly more adult artwork, so be aware of that if you go and check out his stuff and you're not in a good place for it. Also, of course, Infamous Planet, who created the frame that you see around us, he helps out with the show as well. Thank you, buddy. Thank you, Cayman. So the next recommendation that we're taking is...
Oh, yeah. I want to make a big announcement about this, Nick.
Another big announcement?
I know a lot of people have been asking for it. So guys, the next recommendation we're going to be taking is JoJo's Bizarre Adventure Part... Hold on. I'm forgetting something, aren't I?
No, you're not. No, you're not. No. No, we can do JoJo's Part 4.
No, I'm pretty sure I'm forgetting something, aren't I?
No.
That's right.
It's August 23rd.
It's a special.
In 8 days, it'll be August 31st. And then the day after that is October 1st.
It's a special theme
when we do our Halloween horror month.
Special theme month.
And there's nothing in between the two.
It's a special theme month coming up next month. So don't worry, guys. I'm sure I'll remember what my recommendation was going to be at the end of that, when that time comes around. But I think this time we actually have ours picked out for us. Isn't that right, Grumpy Cat Nick?
Next time we do a recommendation, I'll be the Prince of Tennis.
What? Statistics September, everybody. It's going to be crazy. This year, I get to be the one who's like, let's just see how bad this really is. Nick's mulling over every decision he's made to get him to this point right now.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.